This was part of her life story, and who am I to take it away?
The History Podcast from Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds, and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 4th of December. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
Headlines this morning. The energy regulator Ofgem is setting out the cost to consumers of upgrading the network when it reveals what it's allowing companies to spend on their investments. And one other headline. Ministers want to expand the use of facial recognition technology by police, saying it could be the biggest breakthrough in catching criminals since DNA.
Indeed. And coming up on the programme, we will be hearing from one of the survivors from the Manchester synagogue attack, Yoni Finlay, in his first broadcast interview since surviving being shot as he barricaded the doors from the knife-wielding attacker. He tells me how that day has shaped his faith.
It's incredibly difficult. People have asked me how my faith is now after what happened. And the only answer is it's stronger than ever.
More from that interview after 7 o'clock. And Professor Steven Pinker will be joining us on the foresight of George Orwell as he prepares to give the annual lecture in the author's honour. But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The energy regulator Ofgem is to set out its plan for the next five-year period this morning and what effect it might have on consumer bills. It'll explain how it proposes to maintain and expand Britain's gas and electricity networks and how it plans to move away from a reliance on volatile international gas prices. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
Ofgem describes the publication of its five-year plan as a defining moment for Britain's energy system. It aims to strike a balance between investing for the future and how much that costs bill payers. Companies that run energy networks, including power lines and cables, are separate from suppliers. They have monopolies in different parts of the country. This plan sets the framework for how they deliver a safe and secure supply and the cost controls they face for 5 years from next year. Ofgem has already said at its heart will be a move towards a so-called clean power system. This investment can increase the standing charges consumers pay in their bills, but the regulator said the move away from gas will eventually lower costs for consumers and protect households from sudden price shocks, as seen when bills soared 3 years ago.
The Home Office is asking the public for their views about the wider use of facial recognition technology by UK police forces. A 10-week consultation is starting, which could lead to new laws. Ministers want the technology to be used more widely to locate suspects, but campaigners say the public should be protected against mass surveillance. Here's Adina Campbell.
Facial recognition has been in use since 2017. In London alone, the Metropolitan Police made 1,300 arrests using facial recognition over the last 2 years and found more than 100 registered sex offenders breaching their licence conditions. The Home Office has described the technology as the biggest breakthrough for catching criminals since DNA matching and invested almost £20 million since last year. But campaigners say facial recognition surveillance is out of control and expansion could be the end of privacy as we know it.
The White House says President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff will meet Ukraine's top negotiator today to continue talks about a possible peace deal with Russia. Mr. Witkoff met President Putin on Tuesday for talks the Kremlin said had been productive without securing a breakthrough. Mr. Trump told reporters at the Oval Office last night that he couldn't say what would come of the meeting at the Kremlin.
President Putin had a very good meeting yesterday with Jared Kushner and with Steve Witkoff. What comes out of that meeting, I can't tell you, because it does take two to tango. You know, Ukraine, I think we have something pretty well worked out with them. They're very satisfied, considering. It's a very sad situation.
President Putin is in India for 2 days of talks expected to focus on trade. Delhi has been a big purchaser of the Russian oil that's financing the Kremlin's war in Ukraine, but it has been coming under increasing American pressure to end that trade. In August, Washington imposed 50% sanctions on Indian imports to the US. The government has launched an independent review into the diagnosis of mental health conditions, including autism and ADHD. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said there had been a big rise in demand for mental health services in the UK and a review was needed to ensure people were getting the appropriate care. He said earlier this year that conditions were being overdiagnosed. Will Vernon reports.
One in four adults in England now has a common mental health condition, while diagnoses among young people have risen sharply in recent years. That means the numbers claiming disability or incapacity benefits have soared, as have waiting times for those due to be assessed. Announcing the launch of an independent review, Wes Streeting said his department needed to understand why the numbers were rising, to ensure people got the care they needed while bringing waiting lists down. Charities have previously urged politicians to choose their words carefully to avoid stigmatising those affected.
The technology firm Meta has begun to remove the accounts of under-16s from its platforms in Australia ahead of the country's social media ban for children. The new law comes into force next Wednesday. The ban is the first of its kind in the world and is being closely watched by other countries. The future of the Eurovision Song Contest is to be decided at a crucial meeting in Geneva, which starts today. Participating countries will discuss a number of changes to the competition and may also vote on Israel's participation. Germany, which is a key financial supporter, has warned it may pull out if Israel is excluded. Our music correspondent Mark Savage has more.
Israel were the runners-up at this year's Eurovision Song Contest, but countries including Spain, Ireland and the Netherlands have threatened to boycott the competition if the country takes part next year. That's partly due to the death toll from its military action in Gaza, but there have also been accusations of unfair voting practices. Eurovision's organisers have tried to appease those countries by introducing tighter controls on block voting. But if those proposals aren't accepted at today's meeting, it's expected there will be a vote on Israel's participation.
The guitarist Steve Cropper, who helped define the sound of Memphis soul in the 1960s, has died at the age of 84. He was part of Booker T and the MGs, who had a hit with Green Onions, and he played on and co-wrote Otis Redding's classic Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six is the time. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Helen Willits at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Helen.
Morning, Justin. Hello there. Good morning. Well, low pressure's with us today. So compared with yesterday's, well, driest day of the week, good spells of sunshine and some showers, today we have got the rain with us. That rain is currently sitting across parts of England and Wales. I'm going to start with Wales, southwest and southern England, where we've got the band of rain pushing its way eastward. So getting into the southeast of England in the next few hours, it's quite heavy rain stretches right the way up into the Isle of Man as well. So if you're driving around the Cheshire area as well, pretty miserable. Now it does, or it is already clearing away from Pembrokeshire and Cornwall, but showers will follow. Now elsewhere across the rest of England, so Northern England, the Midlands, East Anglia, we will see the cloud already thickening quite quickly this morning and that rain coming in gradually through the day. Not always as heavy except on the higher ground, but very different to yesterday. Temperatures anywhere from 7 to 9 in the rain, but perhaps 10 or 11 when we see the brighter weather coming out in the south. That rain should clear from most of Wales, Southern England into the afternoon. Northern Ireland, wet to start with this morning. No doubt some hill fog as well and a fairly brisk wind. But it should become drier by the afternoon. It may well take a while to brighten up, but some sunshine eventually. Temperatures around 7 or 8 degrees. For Scotland, it's also looking fairly wet across western areas, getting into the central belt now. And it'll push its way gradually across central and southern areas. But I think the far north may escape the main rain today and stay just with a few showers and a little bit of brightness here. But again, sunshine very limited today. Temperatures are between 6 and 8 degrees Celsius across Scotland, but a colder night in store tonight.
Helen, thanks very much. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's take our first look, shall we, at the morning papers and the headlines across the piece. Government plans to expand facial recognition technology and biometrics to catch criminals makes the lead in the Daily Telegraph. Under the proposals, the paper says police will be given wider access to Britain's passport database, allowing officers to compare photos of crime suspects from CCTV, doorbells and dash cams against the facial images of 45 million people. The policing minister, Sarah Jones, tells the paper that the technology has already taken thousands of dangerous criminals off of our streets. But it also quotes the campaigner, Silky Carlo of Big Brother Watch, as saying that an expansion would turn Britain into an open prison, with citizens at risk of misidentifications and injustice.
A leaked report by the Royal College of Physicians on the Blackpool Victoria Hospital is the main news in The Guardian. The paper says it reveals that a culture of systemic bullying and harassment was allowed to flourish among staff, and the safety of patients was affected because of the failings. It quotes the Trust medical director as saying that substantial changes have been made since the report was delivered back in January.
The Times reports on Wes Streeting ordering an independent review of the rising diagnoses of mental health illnesses, autism and ADHD. The paper says the health secretary is concerned they've become the most common reason for a sickness benefit claim. And the review, it says, will ask whether normal feelings and stresses are being over-pathologised.
The Daily Mail reports that the Duchess of Sussex's father, Thomas Markle, is in intensive care in hospital after undergoing emergency surgery in the Philippines. The paper says Mr. Markle, who's 81, was taken ill on Tuesday.
And news that the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is planning to allow pubs in England and Wales to stay open until 1am next summer during the Men's Football World Cup makes the front page of the Sun newspaper. But the paper warns it is a conditional offer. Bit of pressure here, which relies on the home teams actually making it through at least to the quarterfinals of the tournament. So that is, I don't know, incentives. Let's see. It's 10 minutes past six.
And Vladimir Putin is going to India today. Let's talk to Arunoday Mukherjee, who's the BBC's correspondent in Delhi and joins us now for quite a cosy dinner, one-to-one with Narendra Modi, isn't he? How would you characterise Arunoday, the relationship at the moment between those two men?
Well, between Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Russian President Vladimir Putin, relations have always been fairly positive. And I think given the new geopolitical scenarios with President Donald Trump heaping pressure on India when it comes to the purchase of Russian oil, India's relations with China always relatively unreliable. Moscow, in that context, appears to be the more stable partner. And this is also based on historic ties that New Delhi has shared with Moscow since the Soviet era. So India and Russia would be looking to further build on what they already have. Russia, on its part, would want India to continue buying Russian crude oil, which has been a key source of funds, which, of course, has been the big worry for the US that is being used to fund Kremlin's war chest. Russia would also be hoping that India continues to purchase more defense equipment, because in recent years, India has looked to diversify beyond Russia. For Prime Minister Modi, it'll be a tightrope walk, balancing its relations with the US and also ensuring it continues to be friendly with an age-old ally.
Yeah, just to focus for a second on what India gets out of this, what is the reason why Modi seems so keen to keep this relationship going and indeed to continue to buy the oil in spite of many in the West and obviously particularly the United States wanting him not to?
The primary reason that's been given by officials like the Foreign Minister of India at various international platforms is the fact that India is a growing economy. India has a population of 1.4 billion. It needs to ensure it secures its energy needs, and it is very critical for it to continue buying cheap Russian oil to cater to inflation pressures back home. So essentially purely an economic decision, obviously based on also its historic relations with Russia. But also, given the changing stance of the US with that sustained pressure on India when it comes to some of the harshest tariffs of 50%, India is also aware that that relationship is not particularly strong at the moment. So it needs to ensure it has options. And I think it is looking at Moscow in that sense to be one of those options in case things fail. Because it's also important to understand that that trade deal between India and the US still remains elusive. They still haven't been able to patch that up. So India needs to ensure that it is able to withstand any kind of larger pressures if things don't work out with the US.
Arunoday Mukherjee in Delhi. Thank you.
13 minutes past six. Let's turn to that story that we've been hearing in the news and across the headlines, across the papers this morning about facial recognition to be used as a technology to fight crime. How do you feel about it? Do you have strong views? Well, you can make them heard. The government has started a 10-week consultation over plans for police to expand the use of it, saying facial recognition could be the biggest breakthrough in catching criminals since DNA. Adina Campbell is the UK correspondent, our UK correspondent, I should say. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
What is the case that's being made?
Well, as you were saying there, this is a divisive debate. And the government says this has been, you know, the biggest breakthrough since DNA technology. But, you know, it's been used for almost a decade. It was first used back in 2017 during a Champions League football game in Cardiff. And since then, it's continued in areas across South Wales, London and Essex. And it's worth pointing out really the three types in use at the moment. You've got retrospective facial recognition, and that's used in criminal investigations. Then you've got the live facial recognition. People might recognise that from the vans that we see in parts of England and Wales, and those are used to track people passing cameras, and that data is compared against an existing list of wanted people by the police. And then you've also got this operator initiated technology, and that's a mobile app that allows officers to check someone's identity without having to actually arrest them. Now, last month, a new fleet of vans were rolled out to other areas, including Greater Manchester, West Yorkshire and the Thames Valley, in this expanded pilot. But the government wants to ramp the use of facial recognition even further. And it's invested more than £12.5 million last year and a further £6.6 million this year. So now we have this 10-week consultation that started asking people for their views on how the technology should be regulated and how best to protect people's privacy. The Home Office is also proposing to create a regulator to oversee police use of this technology.
And how can you get in touch with the consultation? Is this out there yet?
Yes. So you can get in touch online. But it's really worth saying that this is, you know, very controversial because the Equality and Human Rights Commission, the Equalities Watchdog, described the use of this technology as unlawful earlier this year, saying the rules and safeguards around the use of it fall short and could have an almost chilling effect on individuals' rights. But and that was in relation to the Metropolitan Police using it. But the Metropolitan Police said that the force believed it was both lawful and proportionate. But you have lots of other campaign groups such as Big Brother Watch who say that facial recognition is out of control and the expansion of it could be the end of privacy as we know it.
Adina Campbell, very strong views on this indeed, which we'll come back to, our UK correspondent. Thank you.
16 minutes past six. We're going to find out at 7 o'clock about the impact on energy bills from the regulator Ofgem's five-year plan for investment in the grid. Sean is here with more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yes, so the energy regulator looking to announce how much companies involved in Britain's gas and electricity networks are allowed to include in our bills over the next 5 years. This money going towards funding upgrades, maintenance across the grid. We got a bit of an idea in July about some of it. The regulator saying it's working towards an £80 billion investment programme over what will be this next five-year period, increasing bills, they mentioned at the time, by at least £100 a year by the end of that period. I've got Keith Anderson with me, who's Chief Executive of Scottish Power, so the UK subsidiary of the European energy giant Iberdrola, and Scottish Power, of course, responsible for the infrastructure to transmit the electricity in central and southern Scotland, but also supplying gas and electricity to over 5 million households and businesses around the UK. Keith, morning.
Good morning.
When we have that hint about the level of investment that the regulator will be signing off on, are you expecting the investment levels to be enough to bring down energy bills because of that investment?
Yeah, look, this will be the biggest wave of investment in our electricity infrastructure since it was built by grandfathers back in the 1950s, and it'll give us a system that's fit for purpose for the country for the 21st century. Overall, you know, our estimate and independent estimates will tell you that this will take somewhere between £160 and £170 off bills by 2030. Because it will remove all of the constraint costs on the system. So one of the things you'll regularly now can't them, or people are getting taken off.
Keith, this line is breaking up quite a bit. So I tell you what, we'll try and improve the line and see if we can get you back on such an important topic. Keith Anderson there, who's the boss of Scottish Power. Let's have a look, shall we, at what's going on at the world's largest aircraft manufacturer, Airbus, cutting its delivery target by 4% for this year. It's been warning that hundreds of its popular A320 planes may have a defective metal fuselage panel. Bjorn Firm is an aeronautical analyst at the consultants Liam Company. Bjorn, morning to you. What does this tell us about where Airbus are at the minute?
I think the panel issue, which is a small panel around the forward part of the aircraft, is not a really serious issue. It's a nuisance, and it does deliver the delivery targets of Airbus this year, going from 820 to 790. But it doesn't affect the bottom line. That's why the stock market is not really reacting to it. What is more serious was happened previously with this software glitch, and actually a bit flip glitch in the fly-by-wire computers of the aircraft. That was serious. That was had a safety impact. So,
right, yeah, let's just explain that, because it was only a few days ago thousands of these planes were grounded after that software glitch affected the flight elevation systems on this same model. And I know that was quickly resolved, but are you starting to see a decrease in confidence in Airbus amongst investors, amongst airlines?
Well, you know, Boeing has had a very checkered record and a too bad record, and Airbus has almost had the opposite. You know, it's been this is business as usual. I would say the glitch of not detecting this bit flip. You know, bit flips in computers is something we live with because of cosmic rays. It's just that the software in a fly-by-wire computer should never allow that to actually progress into the fly-by-wire computation of how the aircraft flies. That's just not okay. And that's why the Airbus and the regulator reacted so quickly and so severely. So 6,000 aircraft, if immediately roll back the software, and the 100 old machines that couldn't roll back the software were basically grounded. So that is serious, and that was reacted upon accordingly. But the problem with, you know, we have, I would say, 10,000, if not 20, 50,000 metal panels in the fuselage or the structure of an Airbus of this size. And the problem with one supplier, and it was one supplier of many doing this panel in the forward part of the aircraft, it's a variant thickness. That means they didn't really have 100% control of their production. So the panel could be too thick. Well, then it's not an issue.
Right.
And it could be too thin. And then it could be a long-term issue.
So are you seeing anything like, you know, the conversations that we've heard from the likes of Ryanair about Boeing in recent times? Are there any of those concerns playing out with Airbus yet?
So we're not. It's been too quiet around Airbus. Yeah. They had two visible problems with their production. This is just a business.
Bjorn Firm, thank you for your time. Aeronautical analyst at Liam Company. We have Keith Anderson, Chief Executive of Scottish Power, back. Keith, just to cut to where we were, there's a lot of talk at the minute about, you know, this investment will reduce bills by, I think you said, but, you know, by over £100 by 2030. We hear last week that the government's saying that they'll knock £150 off the people's household bills by transferring some of the costs to the general tax pot. But yet we could well be hearing from Ofgem a little bit later this morning. In fact, we got hints of it in the summer that people are going to see increased cost on their bills because of the investment. Is this confusion helping?
So, yes. We're going to invest between the three transmission companies £60 billion into the transmission network over the next 5 or 6 years. That's what we expect. And that will have a cost impact of maybe up to £50. But when you look at the forecast of the price that's now out to April, that's already been built in. The Chancellor has taken £150 off that forecast. And this, by 2030, will take another £160 off that forecast. So by the time we make this investment, we grow the economy, we get jobs into the country, we'll be bringing down the cost of electricity for everyone in the country. The £150 the Chancellor delivered and the £160 we will deliver.
Now, there's
overall,
a difference, isn't there?
This is very good for customers.
When we talk about the energy costs for households in particular, there's a lot of talk about relative costs, where it would have been if this hadn't happened. Will your customers next year feel £150 better off over the course of the year with their bills?
Yes, if everything else remains equal. So, you know, it depends on things like gas prices, which is why we need to move from gas to electricity. It'll depend on some other factors. But yes, the prices will come down next year from all of the action the Chancellor has taken. And the important thing is this investment into the infrastructure then removes all of the constraints on the system. It will allow this country to build houses. It will allow this country to have investment into data centres, and it will create thousands of jobs.
Will we get to a point where you're not being paid to stop production and some of your wind farms because they're in the wrong place in the country for where the energy demand is? Will this plan today solve that?
Yes, absolutely. So again, all of this investment, that's where the £160 to £170 come. It will remove £5 billion of constraint costs from the system. It will allow everybody to connect. And it, most importantly, it will allow investment into the country. Right now, data centre investors are being told they'll have to wait 5-6 years to connect. This opens up the system. It allows all of that inward investment. It creates economic wealth for the UK and it creates jobs.
Will these plans take into account how much more electricity is going to be needed for all of these data centres we keep hearing about being built? Are we doing enough to actually keep up with that demand?
Well, that's the other important thing, is we need to keep investing in the future of electricity. Your electricity demand around the world is looking to double by 2050. All the forecasts tell you by 2050 it will increase significantly in the UK. So that's why we need to keep up with the investment programme in offshore wind.
But will this plan today, you know, people may well see this demand for electricity shoot up in the coming years and see their electricity costs rise because of that?
No, because if we carry on building what we're doing with offshore wind, onshore wind and solar, we take gas off the system, we reduce the volatility and we bring cheaper renewables power onto the system. The important thing is we need to build enough generation at the same time. You'll be aware that there's an auction taking place now for the next wave of investment in offshore wind, and it's critical we see that come through and we deliver more growth through that as well.
Keith Anderson, Chief Executive of Scottish Power, thank you very much. We've got Sophie Hume with me, Portfolio Manager and Strategist at BNP Paribas Asset Management. Sophie, just listening to that, do investors have confidence that, you know, energy costs for households around the UK will be coming down the way we hear the plan is there?
Hopefully, yes. But I think big picture, long term, is trying to get more reliable sources, as in UK is still very dependent on renewable sources. So how much wind, how much sun we're going to have. So hopefully more plans about nuclear, but also more certainty about where gas price is going to settle could definitely be game changer for our electricity bills.
So if you can ask you about the pound, sterling was up around 1% against the dollar yesterday. There's, you know, alongside that, we see reports of this business activity survey in the UK that was a bit more optimistic than people expected. Is it this telling us something a little more about how businesses are thinking at the moment?
I think yes and no. So I think on sterling, it was more relief rally because positioning was really short going into the budget and somewhat pricing of a potential cyclical upswing into next year with, as you said, some of the soft data, consumer demand looking better. But the question is how much the Bank of England is going to cut when sterling remains quite expensive among other G10 currencies. So let's say how long sterling is going to go up is really the whole question.
Okay, thank you. Sophie Hoon there, Portfolio Manager at BNP Paribas Asset Management. I'll be back after 7 o'clock.
You will indeed, Sean. Thank you very much for that. We will speak to you again then. And Mike's just walked in at 27 minutes past six, wearing a very festive, fetching jumper, may I say.
You like this, Mike? Do you?
I do. I know we're going to talk about the second Ashes test being underway in Brisbane, but I appreciate the jumper.
Thank you. I only bought it yesterday, so he's getting its first outing today. It is a Christmas jumper. You'll be seeing a lot more of this.
A red and cream number for our listeners who cannot see, which is all of you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, as I say, you'll be seeing this a lot more between now and the big day. But let's talk cricket, as you say, Emma, because the second Ashes test is indeed underway. We've had the first session, in fact. This is a day-nighter, remember, so we are currently in what would usually be the lunch break. Instead, it's an extended tea interval. So, the story of the first session. Well, England won the toss, chose to bat, but they made a shocking start.
Last ball of the first over. Stark runs in, bowls to Duckett, who's caught at slip. Duckett's out first ball, and again England lose a wicket in the first over of their innings. Here's Stark, moves in. Ball. Oh, he's played on! Pope's out. England are 5-2. It's all going horribly wrong.
Yeah, I think Phil Tufnell's sigh there spoke for all England cricket fans. At about 4:15 this morning, England 5-2 in just the third over. Ben Duckett out for a golden duck, swiftly followed by Ollie Pope, who in the third ball he faced played on, also out for naught. The lethal Mitchell Starc claiming both wickets for Australia. It all looked pretty desperate. English hopes rested on opener Zach Crawley, who remained at the crease, and Joe Root. And slowly, throughout the first session, England have rebuilt.
Starc bowls to Crawley, turns into the onside, there's his 50. Well, that's a minor triumph for Zach Crawley after his pair in the first Test match. 50 runs, it's come from 68 balls. He signals to the dressing room and then acknowledges the crowd. England have kept faith with him and he's come up with a half century.
Yes, a much-needed half-century for Zach Crawley, his first runs of this series, and he's still there, 61 not out at the break, alongside Joe Root, who is 32 not out. It all means England are 98-2, which, after being 5-2, as we say, is some recovery, and play will get back underway at the Gabba in less than 10 minutes' time. We will be live in Brisbane in the next hour of the programme for an update as we head into this second session. But England 98-2 currently on the day one of the second Ashes Test in Brisbane. Briefly, quick word on last night's football, and you have to say good night all round for Arsenal, who not only were 2-0 winners over Brentford at the Emirates, but saw some of their title rivals lose ground in the title race. Chelsea beaten away at Leeds, whilst Liverpool dropped more points at home. They drew 1-1 with Sunderland, whilst in Scotland, Premiership leaders Hearts dropped more points, conceding a 90th minute equaliser at home to struggling Kilmarnock. A month ago, Hearts were 8 points clear ahead of Celtic at the top of the table, but just one win in their last six matches has left them level on points. Celtic have a game in hand as well, and the two clubs meet at Celtic Park this Sunday.
Mike, thank you. Radio 4 is heading out into the open air this afternoon. Here is Martha Carney.
In the new series of This Natural Life, I have some exceptional guests who all share one passion, a love of nature. That's lifelong for His Majesty the King.
I think always putting something back into nature in return for what we take out.
I also meet comedian Kiri Pritchard-McLean on a love island in North Wales.
Straight ahead of us, that is the grave of Santa Stwynwen, and she is our patron saint of lovers.
Join me, Martha Carney, for This Natural Life this afternoon at 3 on Radio 4, or listen to the series so far on BBC Sounds.
We shall do, Martha. It is 29 minutes to 7. You are listening for now to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. Good to be with you. And now a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
The energy regulator Ofgem will this morning set out its five-year plan for investment in Britain's gas and electricity networks. It says the system will eventually lower bills by moving away from reliance on volatile international gas prices. The investment in what's being called a clean power system could increase standing charges on bills. The government has started a consultation about plans for police to expand the use of facial recognition, which is already in use by some forces in England and Wales. The Home Office says the technology is the biggest breakthrough for catching criminals since DNA matching. Privacy campaigners have warned that facial recognition surveillance is out of control. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is to hold talks in Florida today with Ukraine's top negotiator as they try to agree a plan for ending the war with Russia. Mr. Trump told reporters in the Oval Office last night that his team had a reasonably good meeting in Moscow with President Putin on Tuesday. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, is launching an independent review into mental health services to see what's behind a big rise in demand. Mr. Streeting has previously said that conditions such as ADHD and autism are being overdiagnosed. The government says increased pressure on mental health services has led to long waits for people with an urgent need for help. The future of the Eurovision Song Contest is to be decided at a crucial meeting in Geneva, which starts today. Participating countries will discuss a number of changes to the competition and may also vote on Israel's participation. Germany, which is a key financial supporter, has warned it may pull out if Israel is excluded. And the British Geological Survey says a 3.3 magnitude earthquake hit the northwest of England late last night. The tremor was felt across Lancashire and the Southern Lake District just after 11:23. Some residents of the area said they felt their houses shake.
Thanks very much, Alan. It's 27 minutes to seven. Let's go back to one of those stories Alan was just mentioning, which is also on the front page of The Times, about the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, ordering this independent review of the diagnosis of mental health conditions such as ADHD. As The Times paper puts it, it's part of Labour's fresh crackdown on welfare spending. Henry Zeffman's our chief political correspondent. It's all very well, Henry, good morning, that there'll be a review, but once you have a diagnosis, is it a case of then losing a welfare payment, or the removal of a diagnosis, or the changing of what that might mean? Because there's a concern about pathologising the well or the stresses of the well.
Morning, Emma. Yeah, I mean, I think all of those questions are going to come out, perhaps some of them in the aftermath of this review rather than in the review itself, which is being led by a clinical psychologist and the government emphasising the clinical elements of this review. So just as a reminder of what it is, being launched by the Health Secretary today, it's going to look at rising demand for mental health, ADHD and autism services, and also what is driving it. This is something that Wes Streeting has engaged in publicly before. In March this year, he told the BBC he feared there was an overdiagnosis of mental health conditions, with too many people being written off. And there is that sense from some in government that perhaps some normal stresses and strains are being over-pathologised. This review will reportedly look at factors like social media and smartphones and what role they might play in that. But then the other side of the piece is that the government is also concerned that the increased pressure on mental health services as these diagnoses increase means that some people with very acute needs are facing waits which are too long and having to navigate overstretched services when they need support most.
Okay, and I suppose, do we know any of the timeframes on that?
Yeah, so the review's going to report in the summer of 2026. And as you say, I think after that, it will interact with what the government is looking at on welfare reform. They are very concerned in government in particular about the number of young people who are off work with long-term sickness because they have a mental health condition. Indeed, the number of 16 to 34-year-olds for whom that's the case rose by 76% between 2019 and 2024.
Gosh. Now, of course. That's major in itself, just to pause upon and take in. Just before we let you go, Henry, can I ask you around the postponement of some mayoral elections? Do you know about this?
Yes, I do.
I'm hoping you do.
this is four parts of England which were expected to vote in May next year for new combined authority mayors, directly elected mayors in quite big regions. So they were called Greater Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk, that's together, Hampshire and the Solent, and Sussex and Brighton. Those are now going to be contested for the first time in May 2028 instead. We're expecting formal confirmation from the government later today, and ministers will argue that those areas need more time to reorganise their local government. But opposition parties are absolutely furious, and I expect we'll hear quite a lot of that today.
Yes, James Cleverly, the Shadow Local Government Secretary, has accused Labour of trying to subvert democracy. But as the government has said, it's about the time needed to complete local government reorganisation. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, thank you.
23 minutes to seven. There's been an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. The Israelis say targeting a Hamas terrorist. The Palestinians say killing five civilians, including children. There is also some talk of reopening a key border crossing. Let's talk to Yolande Nell, BBC's correspondent in Jerusalem. Tell us first what we know about the airstrike.
I mean, another test really for the fragile Gaza ceasefire, Justin. Last night, five members of a Palestinian family were killed, including two children, when an Israeli aircraft struck this camp for displaced people. It's Al-Muassi on the coast in the south of Gaza. This is according to the information from local medics. Footage, you know, you can see these orange flames leaping up in this tented area, a line of men struggling to put out the fire, passing buckets of water along, ambulances taking away people who've been badly burnt. Now, Israel said it launched an airstrike targeting what it called a Hamas terrorist in retaliation for an attack earlier in the day, which wounded five soldiers in an area of Gaza that it controls. And a reminder, really, that the Gaza ceasefire has been more of a reduction in fire, really, with almost every day, Israel and Hamas accusing each other of violations. A more positive note, though, for the ceasefire this morning, Israel's announced that it identified the remains of the hostage it received from Gaza yesterday as that of a Thai agricultural worker, Sut Isaac Rintulak, and that leaves only one body, that of an Israeli police officer, as the last of all the hostages remaining in Gaza. That, of course, you know, if his body was given back, would complete the first phase of President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza. President Trump has said last night that the process of the ceasefire in general is going along well and said phase two is moving along. It's going to happen soon. That's, of course, where you get to the thorny issues of post-war governance, security.
Yeah, and before you get to those, you actually have to get more aid in, don't you? And the idea being now that the Rafah crossing is open. This is a crossing, isn't it, into Egypt that Israel controls. Do the Egyptians want it open? Is Israel about to open it?
I mean, this has been complicated by a dispute, really, between Israel and Egypt over the past day, because we had, you know, well, first of all, under President Trump's peace plan, you know, that crossing, Rafah crossing, Gaza's one crossing point into neighbouring Egypt is supposed to be reopened. It was kept closed by Israel, it said, because of this issue over the hostages' bodies not being returned. And then, you know, the World Health Organization, to underline how important this is, has said there are 16,500 sick and wounded Palestinians who need to leave for medical treatment outside, and the Rafah crossing would be the main way to get them out. Now, yesterday, the Israeli defense body, which controls the crossings, COGAT, said that Rafah would now be opened in the coming days for civilians to leave Gaza under the supervision of EU monitors. That's how the crossing would work. Egypt said it wasn't consulted about these arrangements, and it needs to be. And it only wants the crossing to be reopened if Gazans can also go back into Gaza. It should be two ways. And Egypt's big fear, of course, remains of an exodus from Gaza. It said that would eliminate the Palestinian cause for statehood.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem. Thank you.
It's 27. Let's cross to Australia now, where the tech giant Meta says it's begun removing the accounts of under-16s from Instagram threads and Facebook in the country ahead of its social media ban for children next week. The government social media ban, I should say. What do students at Brisbane Girls Grammar School think of this? It's safe to say there are mixed views on the change.
I don't think the ban will directly impact me, but I might find some changes happening over the next few months, as now my friends, like some of them that don't talk to me as often, might talk to me more as they don't have the social media to communicate.
Personally, I don't think this ban will work. Reason being, lots of us are pretty dependent on it. It will be a shock once it's taken away, and some may be having withdrawals, possibly.
I think that it's been introduced too quickly, and I feel that doesn't give people time to get out if they're addicted to social media. It doesn't give them time to, like, get off it.
And maybe figure out a workaround, which is what might be happening already. Katie Watson is our Australia correspondent. It's starting. We've got a bit of a flavour there. Do you think it'll work?
Well, I think everyone's asking that question. Certainly, it's being touted as a world first. There are lots of countries looking at it. There are probably quite a few different groups that also want to see it fail. I mean, the tech companies are pretty cross about it. They have said they agree with the government that there needs to be age-appropriate content on social media, but they don't agree with a ban. I mean, the government's calling it a delay, not a ban, and it does only cover 10 platforms. You know, you've mentioned a couple of the big ones, Snapchat, you know, Instagram, TikTok, but there are plenty more platforms out there that are not covered. And it might be that teenagers will move and migrate over to that. And somebody the other day called it a whack-a-mole situation, where they're going to be going after tech and teenagers working out where they're online, you know, next. And that's going to be a real challenge. The other thing is that gaming's not included. A lot of parents I've spoken to have been really concerned about that. Why on earth that hasn't been included? AI chatbots, messaging, there are plenty of things that are not part of the ban, and I think that's probably the thing that the government's also going to have to address in the months going forward.
We heard what those girls think there, which is important here, and it's sweet in one way. You know, the first girl, what she was saying about people maybe talking to her a bit more in real life, but then obviously through to the reality of the withdrawal symptoms and all of that, which I think again paints a picture of how serious the use of these platforms has become in all of our lives, especially young people's. But what is support like across the country?
So, I mean, it really depends on who you speak to. I think if you speak to the average parent, they probably think this is a great thing because, you know, when their teens come along saying, right, I want to get onto social media, they can go, well, actually, it's not up to me. And the government says, no, you can't. But I was talking to one professor of the internet recently who also flagged that if kids think that what they're doing is going to be wrong because they're banned from social media, and in fact, that's not true because it's the companies, the onus is on the companies to make sure that they're taking reasonable steps to make sure that under 16s aren't on their platforms. And if not, they face a fine of about up to £25 million. But it's not up to, it doesn't matter if, you know, for the kids, there's no implications for the kids or the parents. It's the companies that are going to be to blame. And you know, the concern being is that, you know, what happens to those kids who won't tell their parents if they have found something, some harmful material online, and they feel that they shouldn't be saying something because they're doing something naughty. And I think that message that's coming across, which is it's banned, they can't get on it, a lot of people are feeling is a little misleading and won't necessarily make it safer for young people.
Katie Watson, our Australia correspondent, thank you.
And that brings us to just before 6:45, a week on from the budget, the way the Chancellor handled the whole event, still the number one issue at yesterday's Prime Minister's Question Time. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, saying Rachel Reeves should be sacked, if not prosecuted, Sir Keir Starmer telling her that she was losing the plot. Our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran, reports.
Sir Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves arrived at Prime Minister's Questions together. A week ago, the Prime Minister had been a spectator in the Commons as the Chancellor was challenged by Kemi Badenoch in the immediate aftermath of the budget. Now it was the turn of Rachel Reeves to look on as Keir Starmer faced the Conservative leader for the first time since that statement. A change of cast, but not of subject.
Does the Prime Minister believe that when an organisation descends into total shambles, the person at the top should resign?
Rachel Reeves and other ministers threw the jibe back at Kemi Badenoch and pointed at the Conservative benches as the Prime Minister placed his folder on the dispatch box.
I was very proud to lead this party at the budget last week where the Chancellor set out that we would protect the NHS, which we've done in the budget, create the conditions for economic stability, not repeating the mistake of austerity and bearing down on the cost of living by taking £150 off energy bills. We're fixing the mess that they left, and I'm very proud to be doing so.
Rachel Reeves nodded in agreement, but Kemi Badenoch said the Prime Minister liked to blame everyone except himself.
We now know that the head of the OBR was forced out for telling the truth that the Chancellor did not need to raise taxes on working people. We also know that the Chancellor was briefing the media, twisting the facts, also she could break her promises and raise taxes. Mr. Speaker, if she was a CEO, she would have been fired. And she might even have been prosecuted for market abuse. That's why we've written to the Financial Conduct Authority. So will the Prime Minister ensure the Chancellor fully cooperates with any investigation?
Speaker, she's completely losing the plot.
The OBR, or Office for Budget Responsibility, is, of course, the independent budget watchdog. The chair of the organisation, Richard Hughes, resigned on Monday, taking full responsibility for the mistake which led to the publication of a key document just before the Chancellor made her statement in the Commons last week.
May I pay tribute to Richard Hughes and his leadership of the OBR? He made very clear why he stepped down, and I've made very clear my support of the OBR. But she says take responsibility. Under this Chancellor, Mr. Speaker, growth is up this year, defeating and beating the forecast. Wages are up, more since the general election than in 10 years of the Tories. We've had, I think, 5 interest rate cuts. NHS waiting lists are down. We've had record investment into this country. We're turning the page on their austerity and reckless experiment on borrowing. I'd compare that record to them every day of the week.
As MPs cheered and jeered their way through PMQs, the King was in Windsor, welcoming the German president to the UK for a state visit. It comes as the Prime Minister has been talking about resetting the UK's relationship with the European Union. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, wanted to know how far the government was prepared to go.
The Prime Minister's chief economic adviser has recommended a customs union with the EU
as one of the most effective ways of generating growth. And we agree. So instead of hitting people with higher taxes in the middle of a cost of living crisis, will the Prime Minister change course in economic policy and listen to the piece of wise economic advice from his own economics advisor?
Earlier this week, the Prime Minister gave two speeches in which he talked about Brexit. In one, he said the UK needed to be grown up about the need for a closer relationship with the EU.
We are getting closer relationships with the EU on a number of fronts, including trade and the economy, because that is good for businesses across our country. It's been welcomed by them. We'll continue down that path, but we do have clear red lines in relation to the single market and the customs union.
Next week, the Liberal Democrats hope to force a vote in the Commons on proposals that the UK should start negotiations about a new customs union with the EU. They hope to recruit some Labour MPs to their cause, but Ed Davey had clearly failed to win over the Prime Minister.
Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. It's 11 minutes to seven.
Again and again, we are told that the massive Russian cash reserves frozen in European bank accounts could make a huge difference to Ukraine if they were unfrozen and used to support its effort to fend off the Russians. Again and again, though, nothing much happens except legal talk about how it might be done in theory. Now, though, it seems action is potentially at hand. If only Belgium, where most of the money is held, can be persuaded that it is legally watertight. Let us talk to Elizabeth Brough, who is on the line, who's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Transatlantic Security Initiative. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What's actually being proposed now?
It is quite a clever workaround by the European Commission, which is the body that's proposing it. And what the European Commission wants to do is to back a loan using these assets. So not using the assets themselves, but having them as a guarantee. And that's different from what we've seen in the past when there have been proposals that the funds should simply be used.
And that would then mean what? That eventually they would be paid back, would be the sense. That if at some stage sanctions are reduced or eliminated against Russia and everything goes back to normal, then the money can be returned.
Yes, but there is also the expectation that when the war ends, Russia will have to pay reparations to Ukraine, and that those funds might be part of those reparations. But it's important to remember that you can't just seize assets, even if you've already frozen them. And that has been the complication so far, because we are countries that follow the rule of law. And at the same time, Ukraine needs money, and the only other alternative would be for European countries and any other friends of Ukraine to hand over that money. And that has been the dilemma until now. So this is really quite a clever workaround.
Do you think it's going to work?
If Belgium can be persuaded to agree to this plan, and the reason that Belgium is so concerned is that even if this can be done in a way that lawyers can sign off on, you never know how Russia will retaliate, because Russia is not a country of the rule of law anymore. And this is always a concern when Western countries, European countries, the UK, other Western allies of the Ukraine, of Ukraine, take any sort of actions, that Russia will then retaliate in an illegal way, and there's not very much we can do about it. So, if Belgium can be persuaded to go along with this, if it can be persuaded that its European allies will come to its aid if anything happens, then this could work.
Yeah, it's funny. Just as you're saying that to me, I'm looking at a tweet or an X or whatever we call them now from Dmitry Medvedev, the senior Russian politician, was, of course, president, very close still to Putin, who has, within the last sort of 20 minutes or so, said if the crazy EU does steal frozen Russian assets for a reparations loan, we may view it as a casus belli with all the relevant implications for Brussels and co. Then these funds may have to be returned not in court, but as real reparations paid in kind by Russia's fallen foes. In other words, effectively a threat of war if Europe goes ahead.
Yes, and that's exactly the sort of threats, and these are may not be empty threats. These are also threats that countries have to face today. And we are seeing the same thing over again when it comes to the shadow fleet. If Western countries take action against the shadow fleet, Russia could then escalate. And it is really the dilemma of being countries of the rule of law when Russia has decided not to be a country of the rule of law.
Elizabeth Brough, thank you very much.
It is 7 minutes to seven. And let's go back to that story around facial recognition technology and being used to fight crime. How do you feel about it? There are very strong views. You can make them heard because the government has started a 10-week consultation over plans for police to expand the use of it and hear views on how the technology should be regulated. Ministers have said it could be the biggest breakthrough in catching criminals since DNA. There's a few different types. There's retrospective. There's live facial recognition. So that's live video footage of people passing cameras and comparing that data to an existing list of wanted people. There's operator-initiated facial recognition, a mobile app that allows officers to check someone's identity without having to arrest them and take them into custody. So just tried to give you a bit of a flavour there. Ruth Ehrlich is the head of policy and campaigns at Liberty. Good morning.
Good morning.
The concerns that you have, can you tell us where they're up to? Because I know that the issue of potentially having a regulator was something that you did want, and that has been, well, not granted, but is now being considered, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. We do really welcome the fact that there is finally going to be a proper conversation about the regulation of how facial recognition technology is used, because it's been used for years, basically with no overarching legal framework, which means that police forces have been using it in really different ways. And we know that they're using it for really broad reasons. What we really want to see as a result of this consultation is the introduction of basically common sense safeguards that limit how and when the police can use facial rec.
In terms of the success of it, do you accept that, for instance, when the figures that are shared, such as the Metropolitan Police making 1,300 arrests using facial recognition over the last 2 years and finding more than 100 registered sex offenders breaching their licence conditions, do you see that as a success?
I think what's really important here is to think about what good safeguards could look like, because what we would want to see is restrictions on when the police can use it. And we think that for instances like that, so for catching people who are suspected of having committed a serious offence, plus finding missing people, or if there's an imminent threat to people's safety, those are reasons the police could use facial recognition technology. But as it stands, it's being used to scan the faces of millions of people as they walk down the street.
But how would you do it differently? I don't understand, in the sense of have you not got to use it broadly to catch people?
So the reason that it's so broad is that the police watch lists are enormous. There are tens of thousands of people on them, and they're not people who are all suspected of having committed an offence. They're often victims of crime, they're witnesses to crime. Just this week, there was reporting that uncovered that children as young as 10 are being included on this watch list. They have no idea that they're on there. And I think those children's parents would have real concerns about that and want to know that those watch lists are narrow, being used only for the specific purposes that I set out, which includes finding missing people and keeping people safe.
But, sorry, that's what I'm not understanding. If you are using it specifically, or were to, if it was rolled out in the way that you seem to be describing, how is that very different to what you think is going to happen potentially?
So fewer people's faces would be popped up and registered as a match and as people that the police would be stopping.
Okay, so you're talking about what's to be used as a match.
Yeah, talking about the police watch lists, which currently are huge and have tens of thousands of people on them, but should be much narrower.
I suppose, though, there will be those listening who think we want to give it the best chance of working, and perhaps it's something that strikes you that there is the argument whenever this comes up, well, if I've got nothing to hide, I'm fine being on it.
Yeah, I mean, we all have parts of our life that we want to keep private from each other, from the state, from the police. And I don't think it's completely unreasonable for people not to want to have their faces scanned as they walk down the road. You know, you're having your biometric data scanned as you walk past a camera. It's the equivalent of giving your ID when you go to a shop or to a concert, to a football match. And I actually don't think that many people would be comfortable with that.
Well, this is what the consultation, I mean, it's not a referendum on it, but it will give at least some insight, and also how strongly people feel perhaps as well. Ruth Ehrlich, we will see what happens with this. Head of Policy and Campaigns at Liberty, thank you.
A couple of minutes to seven. Let's look ahead to next week. A new series on Radio 4. It's about housing.
Rocketing prices and rents, a new homes shortage, and an escalation of homelessness. How did the UK's housing crisis unfold, and can it be fixed? I'm Vicky Spratt, and in a new three-part series, I'm travelling across Britain to find out. I'll speak to people at the sharp end of the problems, those who are supposed to be managing them, and those who have ideas about how to fix it. Housing Britain starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Monday morning at 11.
Let's get the latest on the weather with Helen Willett. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Emma. Change today after yesterday's fine weather. We've got a band of rain with us. So let's start with England and Wales. It's sitting across northwest England through northern and eastern Wales down to the Isle of Wight, getting into the greater London region now. So all edging its way eastwards through the day, replaced by drier weather already in the southwest of Wales, Cornwall and Devon, but showers, which could be quite heavy, even the old rumble of thunder. That all rattles through during the day today. So very different complexion, lots of cloud around compared with yesterday. A fairly stiff breeze with the rain, but it eases off later. Temperatures today around about 7 or 8 in the rain to 9 to 11 if we see some brightness late on. Northern Ireland also stuck under this rain band this morning, so large puddles on the roads. I should imagine quite heavy rain for a time, but getting drier the afternoon, and it might even brighten up with a little bit of late sunshine here. About 6 or 7, I think, the temperature here. And for Scotland, well, I think the north may not see that much rain, but the rain is quite heavy now, pushing into the central belt across Glasgow. It'll stagger northwards and eastwards, really slow progress today, but eventually getting to most parts, even though it'll turn patchier. It may well dry up in the southwest later. Temperatures, though, again, around the 6 or 7 degree mark, not particularly warm.
Helen, thank you for that. You're listening to Today with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 4th of December. The headlines. Ofgem is announcing how much firms can spend on improving the energy network and how much that might cost consumers, rather. The government is set to delay elections for newly created mayors in parts of southern England and has been accused of denying democracy. We'll speak with Richard Tice, the deputy leader of Reform, in a few minutes. The guitarist Steve Cropper, who helped define the sound of Memphis soul, has died at the age of 84. The news is read by Alan Smith.
The energy regulator Ofgem is setting out its priorities for the next 5 years and how it wants to change Britain's gas and electricity networks. It'll explain how it proposes to maintain and expand the networks and also how it plans to move away from a reliance on volatile international gas prices to benefit consumers in the future. But as our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey explains, what's planned will have an impact on household bills in the short term.
Ofgem describes the publication of its five-year plan as a defining moment for Britain's energy system. It aims to strike a balance between investing for the future and how much that costs bill payers. Companies that run energy networks, including power lines and cables, are separate from suppliers. They have monopolies in different parts of the country. This plan sets the framework for how they deliver a safe and secure supply and the cost controls they face for 5 years from next year. Ofgem has already said at its heart will be a move towards a so-called clean power system. This investment can increase the standing charges consumers pay in their bills, but the regulator said the move away from gas will eventually lower costs for consumers and protect households from sudden price shocks, as seen when bills soared 3 years ago.
A consultation is asking people how police can expand the use of facial recognition to catch criminals while still maintaining public trust. Ministers want the technology to be used more widely to locate wanted suspects, but campaigners say the public should be protected against mass surveillance. Here's Adina Campbell.
Facial recognition has been in use since 2017. In London alone, the Metropolitan Police made 1,300 arrests using facial recognition over the last 2 years, and found more than 100 registered sex offenders breaching their licence conditions. The Home Office has described the technology as the biggest breakthrough for catching criminals since DNA matching, and invested almost £20 million since last year. But campaigners say facial recognition surveillance is out of control, and expansion could be the end of privacy as we know it. The consultation will ask when and how the technology should be used and what safeguards are needed to protect people's privacy. The government is proposing to create a regulator to oversee police use of facial recognition.
The government is set to postpone elections for newly created mayors in some parts of southern England. It had announced an extension of what it called its devolution priority programme in February and said the new positions would be delivered at pace. Opposition parties are calling for the elections to go ahead as planned. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
Four parts of England were expected to vote for new directly elected mayors in May next year. But these combined authority contests in Greater Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk, Hampshire and the Solent and Sussex and Brighton are now set to be delayed by 2 years, meaning they will be first contested in May 2028. Formal confirmation is expected from the government later today. Ministers will argue that the areas need more time to reorganise local government. Opposition parties are furious. Sir James Cleverly, the shadow local government secretary, has accused Labour of trying to subvert democracy. Zoe Franklin of the Liberal Democrats said the decision was a disgrace. Reform UK Zia Yusuf said this was a blatant attempt to stop big reform wins next May.
The communications regulator Ofcom says it's fining a porn company £1 million for not having robust age checks in place. The announcement comes ahead of a report it's publishing on how the online safety landscape is changing following the introduction of new UK laws coming into effect this year. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is to have talks in Florida today with Ukraine's top negotiator as they try to agree a plan for ending the war with Russia. Mr. Trump told reporters in the Oval Office last night that his team had a reasonably good meeting in Moscow with President Putin on Tuesday, even though no agreement was reached. Here's our North America correspondent David Willis.
Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner presented Vladimir Putin with a new version of a US peace plan, amended after concerns were raised that the initial draft made too many concessions to Moscow. But the US delegation failed to persuade Vladimir Putin to agree to the new terms. Russia's president has accused European leaders of undermining the US initiative, and after more than 2 weeks of back-and-forth negotiations, President Trump has conceded the next step in the process is unclear.
The Health Secretary Wes Streeting is launching an independent review into mental health services to see what's behind a big rise in demand. Mr. Streeting has previously said that conditions such as ADHD and autism are being overdiagnosed. The government says increased pressure on mental health services has led to long waits for people with an urgent need for help. NHS bosses are urging people not to clog up A&E with minor complaints after figures revealed thousands sought hospital treatment last winter for issues such as hiccups and ingrowing toenails. NHS England said it was vital the public used emergency care responsibly. Here's our health correspondent Nick Triggle.
Last winter, there were more than 200,000 A&E visits in England for minor conditions that could have been dealt with elsewhere, according to NHS figures. That represents more than 2% of all attendances. They include more than 6,000 visits for nasal congestions, nearly 4,000 for ingrowing nails and another 96,000 for sore throats. NHS England said busy A&E units were no place for these patients and said there were plenty of other options, including pharmacies, NHS 111 and GP services, particularly through their new online systems. A&E, NHS bosses said, should only be used for life-threatening and serious conditions, although research does show one of the factors driving people towards A&E is difficulty accessing their GP.
A doctor in California who supplied ketamine to the actor Matthew Perry before he died of an overdose has been sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Salvatore Plasencia is the first person to be jailed in connection with the death of the star of the sitcom Friends in 2023. The future of the Eurovision Song Contest is to be decided at a meeting in Geneva, which starts today. Participating countries will discuss a number of changes to the competition and may also vote on whether Israel should be allowed to participate. Ireland and Spain are among the countries who want Israel excluded. Germany, which is a key financial supporter of the event, has warned it may pull out if Israel is barred. The influential guitarist, producer and songwriter Steve Cropper has died at the age of 84. His unique guitar sound helped drive the instrumental quartet Booker T and the MGs, and he played on and produced soul classics including Otis Redding's The Dock of the Bay. Tom Dewsbury looks back at his career.
Steve Cropper was the guitarist for Booker T and the MGs, who rose to fame in 1962 with Green Onions, a top three hit in the US. It became the defining instrumental track of the Memphis soul sound. Booker T and the MGs were also the house band for Stax Records, which saw Cropper play on classic songs such as Sam and Dave's Soul Man, Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood, and Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, which he co-wrote with Otis Redding. Steve Cropper's career stretched across seven decades. As a member of Booker T and the MGs, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1992.
Cricket, and on the first day of the second Ashes test in Brisbane, England made a terrible start, losing one wicket in the first over before falling to 5 for 2 soon afterwards. Zach Crawley steadied the side but has just been caught out for 76. A short time ago, the tourists were on 127 for 3. Australia lead the five-match series 1-0.
Thank you for that. It is 7:09. What is going to happen to all of our energy bills is the only way up, despite what the Chancellor said last week when announcing that bills were actually going to go down by £150. We are told by the energy regulator Ofgem that now is a defining moment for Britain's energy system. It's publishing a five-year plan this morning, setting out the boundaries for investment in Britain's gas and electricity networks. Simon Jack, our business editor, has been reading it fast, I should imagine, because it has only just come out. Simon, what can you tell us?
So they've given the green light for £28 billion of investment now, part of £90 billion of investment over the next 5 years. And what that will do is add £108 to bills by 2031. However, the fact that more of our offshore wind will be able to connect to this and won't they have to be paid to be switched off because they can actually get the power to where it's needed will reduce bills by £80, less than they would have been had this not happened. So if you like, there's a bit of a wash, but we end up with £30 roughly extra on bills by 2031. Just to be clear what this is like the subsea cables, the overground pylons, which basically connect the energy from where it's generated, roughly, you know, a lot of it out at sea off the east coast of Scotland and England, and into the places where it's used. So those are the infrastructure you need. The industry will tell you, and Keith Anderson did a little earlier, that it'll create thousands of jobs, but it will place upward pressure on bills. At the moment, however, a lot of these offshore wind farms are being paid to switch off. Those are called constraint costs. And the idea is that if you have a better grid with more places where you can connect, that doesn't happen. And that's why some bills will be lower than they otherwise would have been. But the direction of bills is up.
Which will suggest to some that politicians right across the board, actually, particularly when net zero was a very big thing and everyone was signed up to it, which they're not all now, politically speaking, that actually they weren't really quite open with us about what the system costs of this transition were going to be.
I think that's one of the major criticisms of the sort of net zero plan is that, you know, everyone wants lovely green energy, which is renewable and really domestic and homegrown and not reliant on foreign dictators and all that kind of stuff. But there is a feeling that people weren't told exactly how much this revolution would actually cost. And it does add to bills over time. However, the industry will tell you, this is not a nice to do, this is a must do. If you want data centers and electric vehicle charging points and all that good stuff, then you're going to have to upgrade the grid, and this is the way it's going to do the way you're going to have to do it. Of course, it will also be a very interesting test of the government's new planning regime. You've got a planning and infrastructure bill going through, and by designating this stuff as critical national infrastructure, you have an inbuilt tendency to approve this stuff unless it's not done legally. So judicial reviews will be harder to do. But nevertheless, I do expect there to be a massive fight over planning when you're going to have a lot of pylons, for example, over places like East Anglia. I think that will be a fight yet to come.
Yeah. And Ofgem also saying it reduces our reliance on gas, which they say is liable to price spikes and all the rest of it. I mean, there are economists, aren't there? You think of Dieter Helm at Oxford, who say, hang on a second, gas is actually not as expensive as we keep being told it is, or as liable to hikes. There was obviously a big one. There's a big one after the pandemic. There's a big one after Russia invaded the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But actually, generally, gas prices aren't particularly high, the critics of all of this say.
Well, we are still very reliant on gas, and we get a lot of our gas imported either from Norway in the form of LNG, it comes from Qatar, it comes from the US. I think what the proponents of this plan will tell you is that we still are linked, the electricity price is very much linked to gas, because that tends to be the bit of the energy mix which kind of clears and matches supply and demand. So we are, that fixes the price for much of it. What this will do is help to break that link. And as you say, it's not always, gas can be pretty reliable, but I think it's still fresh in people's minds. And, don't let a good energy crisis go to waste and sort of say, when you do get these rocketing prices, it can have a very, very disruptive effect on our energy supply. So they would say this is a good thing. If you've got homegrown electricity, better to have your prices linked to that cost rather than volatile gas prices.
And we'll be hearing directly from Ofgem at 10 to 8. Simon Jack, thanks.
13 minutes past seven. Four English mayoral elections that were due to take place next May will be postponed by 2 years. Voters in Greater Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk, Hampshire and the Solent and Sussex and Brighton will now have to wait until 2028 to vote for a new mayor. We expect the government to make a formal announcement later today saying more time is needed to get ready for the reorganisation. Richard Tice is the deputy leader of Reform. Good morning. Your views on this postponement?
Well, generally it's dictators that cancel elections. I mean, some 7.5 million people are now going to be denied the opportunity of voting in mayoral elections. Funny, isn't it? We've just announced our mayoral candidates for all of these areas, and all of a sudden, the government, terrified of losing to Reform, are cancelling them. And I feel
it's nice to make it all about you, but what if it's actually true what they're saying?
And they're cancelling elections? That is going to be true, yes.
No, the reason, if I was just going to say, I mean, the Sun newspaper has reported that there may be a further pledge of money for these new mayors, and it's a question of timing. The elections will happen in 2028. Why, if it ends up being better potentially for a Reform mayor with more money, would you not want to get that in place?
I think that is, I think that's just naive. I mean, we were told by... We were told by the then Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, a year ago when she cancelled the county council elections in May 2025. She said they were definitely going to happen in May 26. This is just the beginning. We expect the government will also cancel more county council elections. I think they're just running scared. I mean, there is no reason to cancel elections. They're all ready to go. People have been spending money. People have been spending money.
That they need more time to organise, and there may be a further pledge of money. Are you not able to accept that at face value?
No,
Do you not sound like a bit of a why are you creating a conspiracy when there might not be?
There is just a fear of how successful Reform are doing. They've been talking about these mayor elections for years and years. They've been getting ready. Our candidates have been spending money already, getting going. People have been campaigning, leafleting. So, and I think millions of people, over 7 million people who were furious at having elections cancelled last May are now, frankly, wondering what sort of democracy we're living in, where the government can just cancel yet more elections willy-nilly at their pleas.
Could it not be that there's a lack of organisation, which, again, you could rightly criticise the government for, but do you not worry about stoking this sort of message?
No, if they haven't got themselves organised, maybe they need to work a longer day, 24/7, work some weekends. Democracy is fundamental to who we are in the United Kingdom. And because they say they're not organised, they can't do it. If they're not organised...
So if there was a further pledge of money that you were to miss by... let's say were successful...
So you have to wait 2 years. I mean, you could say, terribly sorry, we've got a bit delayed, we're going to delay it a month. Right, we could probably live with that, but to delay it 2 years, no, that is a deliberate, dictatorial cancelling of democracy in the United Kingdom.
We shouldn't tolerate it. You've just mentioned the word dictatorial. Let's talk about your leader Nigel Farage's relationship when he was younger with Hitler, shall we? Because 20 people told The Guardian.
I'm sorry.
20 people told The Guardian that Nigel Farage behaved in a racist and anti-Semitic way at school, with direct quotes from pupils, all and some of them named, that he was joking about gas chambers, putting a pupil in detention when he was a prefect for the colour of their skin, and directly saying to Peter Ettergy that Hitler was right, a Jewish pupil. So, yes, talking directly about Hitler with witnesses to some of this. Looking at what Nigel Farage, because you're not Mr. Farage, I accept that, what he said in response to the BBC last week about this, he said, "Have I said things 50 years ago that you could interpret as being banter in a playground that you can interpret in the modern light of day in some sort of way? yes. But I have never directly racially abused anybody, no.
There's your answer. You were told last week, why are you raising it again when we're talking about county council elections?
You've just talked about freedom of speech. You've also talked about how you believe your party should be leading those places. That's exactly why I am. And while I have that freedom of speech, I'll use it. I'm sure you'll like me to. Do you think saying to a Jewish person, Hitler was right, is direct racial abuse?
Yes, I do. And I'm quite sure that I can't believe anybody would have said that. And this is
including your leader.
This is all made up twaddle by people who don't want Nigel to be Prime Minister of the country. Funny how they didn't remember this 3 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
He told Michael Crick some years ago of this. He's a BAFTA and Emmy winning director and producer, whose grandparents came here from Nazi Germany. He has never forgotten it, because let me tell you, if you are racially abused, which you won't have been, Richard Tice, I suspect, you don't tend to forget it. It gets etched in your memory. So do you think saying to a Jewish person, chambers with a hiss, is banter? Let's go to the other part of his statement.
This is made up nonsense by someone who has got a politically biased motive. And let me tell you, no one has stood up against anti-Semitism more than Nigel and I. We were the ones who immediately after October 7th said we were very worried about the protests, the pro-Palestine protests that were inciting hatred, anti-Semitism and violence. And that's exactly what they did. And that weak leadership, not banning those vile anti-Semitic protests, has led us to the very bad place that we are in today.
You have just said that the Jewish man who said this happened to him at school is a liar, in the same breath that you said you stood up for the Jewish communities in this country.
And I have stood up for the Jewish communities, and I get thanked for that every day.
Sorry, but you've just said that a man who's in his own right a director and producer, he's not a political operative, you've just said he's lying.
Yes.
But you don't know that. So you're lying within your lie, potentially.
No. No, I just don't think. I think this is made up twaddle by a whole bunch of people.
He said
with
it
a political
for years, and he has witnesses.
I think these people have a political axe to grind. And do you know, every week the voters are going out in by-elections and they're voting for reform because they're not buying into this sort of left-wing anti-Nigel narrative. Look at what
Richard
the voters are doing.
Richard Tice, Deputy Leader of Reform. Thank you very much.
20 past seven is the time. One of the UK's largest investment platforms, AJ Bell, has said it also saw customers withdrawing money from their pension pots in the run-up to the budget. Sean is back with that.
Yeah, yesterday we heard the boss of one of the biggest wealth managers, St James's Place, telling us uncertainty ahead of the budget had meant people's pensions were damaged as they took money out. Today, AJ Bell, with its more than 650,000 customers on its platform, say it saw similar trends. Michael Summersgill is the chief executive of AJ Bell. Michael, morning.
Good morning, Sean.
You say in your results heightened pension withdrawals. What proportions were being taken out compared to previous times?
Well, it's a repeat of the issue that we saw last year. So we did see hundreds of millions of pounds of additional withdrawals from pensions, and that's people who are at or around retirement reacting to the uncertainty in that long drawn out period up to the budget when there was no comment from government on their policy here, and rumour and speculation filled that void. Now, for people who are approaching retirement, whether they do or don't get an element of tax-free cash on their pension withdrawal clearly has a significant impact. So, you know, they reacted to that. And yes, we saw what others across the industry have seen, a significant increase in customers withdrawing money from the pension system, which obviously has long-term ramifications for them and the UK capital markets.
Michael, in terms of other policies that we heard about the budget, we got that confirmation that there'd be a reduction in the amount that UK savers can put into cash ISAs from £20,000 to £12,000. Have you seen behavioural changes because of that since last Wednesday?
We saw some behavioural changes in the ISA market in the lead up to the budget. Again, speculation, you know, it was a long trailed policy proposal that the cash ISA limit would be reduced, and when the focus shifted to transfers from stocks and shares ISAs into cash ISAs being banned as part of a raft of complex measures, which has since been confirmed, that is what we have seen. People did start to move money from stocks and shares ISAs to cash ISAs. Now, I don't want to overstate that. That wasn't a significant change in the way that we saw in the pensions market, but again, shows people reacting to what I see as a really poor set of policy measures in the ISA market.
Just finally, you know, Michael, on your just results this morning, you're seeing profits up again and your profit margin up again. You know, this time last year we were talking about record numbers. Are customers going to start sort of questioning the increased profits, ever-increasing profits of an investment platform that they're on and the value for money they're getting?
I think what we've done very well here is we make sure that as we grow the business, these businesses scale very effectively. So you are able to increase your profit margins. But along the way, we reduce the prices that customers are paying for consuming the service. So it's an important part of the way that we run the business that our shareholders, our customers and our staff all benefit from the growth of the business. So we reduced prices. The last time we did it was just over a year ago. And in the year that we've seen here, there was over £20 million worth of benefits that customers have received as a result of those lower charges. So one of the most competitively priced platforms in the market, and customers trust that philosophy that we have that will continue to drive prices down over time.
Michael Summerskills, Chief Executive of AJ Bell, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sean. 23 minutes past seven. Vladimir Putin visits India today. He'll have a private dinner with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The India-Russia friendship mattering, of course, because India is not firmly in the orbit of the Russians. It's not North Korea, it's not Iran, but it's not firmly in the orbit of the West either. Indeed, its relationship with the Trump White House has not been good, to put it mildly. Let's talk to Sir John Sawyers, former chief of MI6, who is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What's your assessment of what's going on here, what the two men can and can't agree in terms of furthering their relationship now?
Well, I think for Russia, the advantages are very obvious. Putin wants to break out of the isolation that international sanctions have imposed on him because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There is good business that Russia can do in India in the defense field, in civil nuclear, and above all in trying to maintain the very high level of Indian imports of Russian oil that we've seen over the last couple of years. India has turned to Russia as its main source of oil imports during the course of the war, and they get a good discounted price on it. What's more nuanced and complicated is what India gets out of this relationship. Now, India's move towards the West over the last 25 years, the West has accepted it is a nuclear power, and the technology connections with India, especially between India and the United States, have been growing. And of course, India is very well placed to be the fastest growing major global economy over the next decade. So for India, it's got a complex set of relationships it's got to manage. But its biggest security threats come from China and Pakistan, who are aligned with one another. And the most reliable source of defense supply for India over the last 30 or 40 years has been Russia. So I think there's a strong defense component in the Indian interests here. And they're looking, it seems, for more updated air defense systems, which didn't do very well in their latest spat with Pakistan, and with the latest Russian fighter aircraft as well. So I think that's the main Indian concern.
Has there also been, would you say, a mishandling of the relationship, of the US-Indian relationship, by the Trump White House?
Very much so. It's astonishing, really, how casually Donald Trump has discarded the Indian relationship with the very high levels of progress that have been made over the last 25 years, including in his first term, where there seemed to be a sort of a bromance between Modi and Trump. This time, Trump unwisely claimed credit for something he hadn't done, namely broker a peace between India and Pakistan after the terrorist atrocities in Kashmir. That embarrassed Modi. He responded by embracing Xi and Putin in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Beijing back in the summer. And Trump has responded with 50% tariffs on India, which just about scuppers Indian exports to the United States. So I think the Trump White House has badly and rather casually damaged the U.S.-India relationship. And the Indians have never been sort of an ally of the United States, but they want to have what they call multi-alignment. They want to be to have their own relationships, even difficult ones with China and easier ones like with Russia, Europe and the United States. And the United States has unnecessarily damaged that.
Is there, though, a wider context again, though, that India is susceptible to being at least embarrassed on the world stage if it's too close to a nation that has invaded another nation, slaughtered civilians, is attempting to rewrite a border by force, etc., etc., all the things that you would expect. I mean, actually, in a sense, particularly in the global south, people at least rhetorically would be against.
That's true. And you don't need to persuade me of the horrors of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But I think actually the arguments that we in Europe and the have put forward about the horrors of the Russian invasion, actually they've not landed that well in what's generally called the global south, of which India is a prominent player. It is quite interesting how nuanced the approach of leaders in South Africa, in Saudi Arabia, Brazil, India, and so on, have been towards the... They don't share the same horrors that we have about what Russia is doing there.
Because they see it as hypocrisy.
There's always that historical element to it. Also, I think they all see some benefits in keeping in line with Russia, and that's certainly the case with India because of the dependence that India has on Russian defence supplies, the opportunities they have to be a major technology supplier to Russia, and cooperation in the civil nuclear field. So the Indians will be looking to they are in strategically more aligned with Europe and the United States in their thinking. But the way in which the Trump administration has pushed them back, embraced the much weaker regime in Pakistan, not quite clear why they've done that. There's a talk of the Trump family having a crypto business in Pakistan, which has influenced their whole approach to the subcontinent. So I think countries are looking after their own interests here. And there's real opportunities, actually, for Europe and the UK in building a closer relationship with India. India likes dealing with Western countries. The rule of law applies. There are the good trade and technology benefits from doing so. But India is not going to throw its lot in with the West completely. It's going to try and manage a set of balanced relationships across its historical partners.
Sir John Saws, thank you.
At 7:30, Mike has just joined us in his lovely festive jumper to update us on the sport, namely the Ashes, I think, first of all.
Yes, you're right, Emma, because we have a breakthrough in Brisbane for Australia.
Nisa Bowles, Crawley tried to swing it away, as he caught behind, he is. It was a short ball, he went to pull it, he got something on it, and Australia have made the breakthrough. And Zach Crawley out for 76.
Yes, you can't take your eyes off day one of this second Ashes test. Zach Crawley had helped England rebuild from 5-2 early on this morning. His half century helping steady the ship. It got them to 98-2 at the tea break alongside Joe Root. But 20 minutes into the second session, Crawley fell. Short ball from Michael Nisa, as you heard, meant the opener was out for 76. England currently now 152 for three. Let's head live to the Gabba. Come in, Henry Moran, who's there for us live this morning. Hi, Henry.
Hi there, Mike.
So a word first on Crawley and his efforts with the bats so far. I mean, boy, did he need those runs. Out for a pair in the first test in Perth. That will have done him, that 76, the world of good.
It will. He'll be very frustrated not to have gone on to get 100, but 76 from 93 is a very valuable contribution, particularly given the context of what was happening at the other end early on. Mitchell Starc taking a wicket in the first over once again to remove Ben Duckett first ball, and then Ollie Pope was bowled third ball off an inside edge. So he and Joe Root did a brilliant job, really, in rebuilding things for England. Crawley gone, though, since the first break of the day, but Root has now reached his 50. Let's not forget he's never made 100 in Australia, but he's at this stage looking good. He's on 50. Harry Brook at the other end on 22.
Yeah, and Brook not hanging about either, is he? 22 currently off 20 balls. Harry Brook has ridden his luck as well at times, but he looks like he means business.
He does. It's the way he plays. He's an aggressive batter. He's the sort of player that is going to look to try and move the game forward on a surface. Has to be said that has looked pretty docile so far. You always know that a fielding side is feeling frustrated with the lack of breakthroughs when they ask to have the ball changed quite as regularly as Australia have so far. It's a pink ball, and there have been various criticisms over whether it goes a bit soft, a bit quickly. But England, having got through the pressure of Mitchell Starc early on, to an extent he got those two wickets. wickets, but nothing beyond that in the first session, and no Pat Cummins for Australia. Well, they'll be feeling that if they can just keep this momentum going, they could be in a position to make a decent total.
Just finally, Henry, we are, what, roughly halfway through this day one of the second Ashes test. It's a day-nighter, of course, in Brisbane. A lot of talk ahead of this was, did this series really need a day-night test? Ashes matches usually sell out of their own accord. What is the atmosphere like at the Gabba?
It's been a fabulous atmosphere all day, and it was all morning as well. England supporters all over Brisbane making their way towards the ground, and a real sense of occasion. Yeah, there's controversy over whether the Ashes needs it. Certainly Joe Root seemed to suggest it wasn't the case. But as a television event for Australian audiences heading towards the Christmas holidays, it's certainly something that's very popular. And for the fans as well, it does seem to certainly bring in a big crowd. So, yeah, it's not for everybody, but England and enjoying that that pink ball at the moment.
154 for three currently, England. Henry Moran live at the Gabba for us this morning. Many thanks. We shall return to Brisbane in the next hour of the programme to see how England are faring against Australia, and should say, of course, you can follow the match live with ball-by-ball commentary right now with the Test Match special team over on BBC Sounds.
You can indeed, Mike. Thanks very much.
Make family time stress-free this Christmas with CBeebies Parenting. There's loads of things to do. Simple recipes to try together and activities to keep your little one learning as they play. Games with your favourite characters.
You can also use these buttons.
And, of course, all the shows you can watch together.
This is amazing.
Share some magic moments this Christmas. CBeebies Parenting. Here when you need us. Search CBeebies Parenting.
To the weather, showery spells of rain progressing northeastwards across the UK. Sunny spells and scattered showers in the south later on.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnes. It's 26 minutes to 8 and our summary of the news with Alan Smith.
The energy regulator Ofgem says it wants to invest up to £90 billion in the gas and electricity networks over the next 5 years as part of its plan to maintain and expand the systems. It wants to improve connections to offshore wind farms with undersea cables, as well as more electricity pylons. The measures will add £108 to bills by 2031, but Ofgem says bills will be £80 lower than they would be if the investment wasn't made. A pornography company is being fined £1 million by Ofcom for not having robust age checks in place, which are required by the Online Safety Act. The regulator has published a report saying that firms have taken action to improve age checks, but that there are concerns that social media sites have lowered their moderation standards on hate speech. The government has launched a consultation asking how police can expand the use of facial recognition to catch criminals while maintaining public trust. Some forces in England and Wales already use the technology, which privacy campaigners say is getting out of control. Four mayoral elections due to take place in England in May are set to be postponed by 2 years. The BBC has learned the mayoralties in Greater Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk, Hampshire and the Solent, and Sussex and Brighton will now be held in 2028. The government says the areas need more time to complete their local government reorganisation. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is meeting Ukraine's top negotiator in Florida today as they try to agree a plan to end the war with Russia. Mr. Trump says his team had a reasonably good meeting with President Putin on Tuesday. And NHS bosses are urging people not to clog up A&E with minor complaints after figures revealed thousands sought hospital treatment last winter for issues such as hiccups and ingrowing toenails. NHS England says it's vital the public used emergency care responsibly.
Alan, thanks very much. It's 24 minutes to 8. On October the 2nd of this year, Yonny Finlay, a 39-year-old father of four, was nervous. He was preparing to help lead the Yom Kippur prayers at his synagogue for the first time on the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. Except that never really happened, because not long after the service began that morning, a local man named Jihad al-Shami drove at the gates of the synagogue, ran over a security guard, stabbing two security volunteers, one of whom to death, Melvin Kravitz, before running at the doors with what looked like an explosive device around his waist while brandishing a large knife. Yonny found himself alongside several others, including the congregation's rabbi, bravely barricading the doors of the synagogue, or shul, the Hebrew word for such a building, to stop the killer from entering as he rammed the doors with his body. And then suddenly, everything stopped. Yonny was shot by a police bullet.
The same bullet, it is amazingly thought to have first passed through the body of the attacker, killing him, before going through Yoni, and then into his friend and fellow congregant Adrian Dalby, killing him in the process. In his first broadcast interview for my new podcast Ready to Talk with Emma Barnett, I asked him how he's processing that reality and information.
It's incredibly difficult. It's... People have asked me how my faith is now after what happened. And the only answer is it's stronger than ever. And I think the only way I can get through this is by faith. I know that what happened to me was a miracle. I know that for whatever reason, God chose to save me on that day, which gives me responsibility as well.
That's how you view it?
Absolutely. It's the only way you can. Because I was centimetres, millimetres, whatever it was. You know, if I'd been one step to the left or one step to the... Who knows? I wouldn't be here now. So, again, it's dealing with that. But then that's where my faith comes in. For whatever reason, I've been given more time. It comes with the responsibility as well of I can't waste that time.
Do you feel that now?
Yeah, 100%. You have to, because if you come that close, which I did, then it makes you realise how... People talk about how fleeting life is, but it really is, because from one moment to the next, I'm preparing to lead the service, go through Yom Kippur and carry on with my day-to-day. And in that moment, everything just stops.
Can you just say a bit more about, you know, very few people have been close to what the police has now called a terrorist attack and actually to the attacker and survived. What did that feel like, being close to someone so hell-bent on trying to kill the people you were with and you?
It's a very shocking thing to be in the presence of somebody who just wanted to kill Jews. That's all he wanted to do, and he was prepared to die for that. And it's not a nice thing to be in the presence of. It really isn't. And to feel it coming off him, and it really was in waves. He was there for one purpose only that morning, because he wanted to kill Jewish people. And it's a horrific thing to be in the presence of.
And a horrific thing to be fighting, you know, yes. Holding. What are your memories of the police arriving?
So the police arrived and came into the courtyard. He came down the steps towards them quite aggressively. They were shouting armed police.
And were you watching through the window?
So watching through the window, and presumably because of the bomb that they thought he had, they had to open fire, they had to stop him. So they shot him a number of times, and he went down. But he got back up.
Did he?
He got back up after he'd been shot, and again, quite aggressively moved towards them, which is when they shot him again. That's when I felt the bullet go into me.
So did you watch him be shot?
I watched him be shot. I watched him go down twice.
Again, not something you've ever imagined yourself witnessing.
No.
And that in itself would be incredibly traumatic to witness, not least what you've just been through. And then it comes through the door, is that right?
So I was told afterwards that it possibly come through him, then through the door, and then into me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt. It didn't hurt me.
It doesn't hurt?
It just feels like someone's punched you really, really hard.
On your side, which is where you said you'd...
Yeah. And I like to think I fell quite gracefully to the floor. So,
do you remember falling?
Yeah, I was conscious all the way until the operating theatre.
Okay. And it just feels like a smack into the body?
Like a really hard punch is the best way I can describe it.
Have you ever been punched before?
Not that hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, you know, slightly piecing together what you know now and what you knew then, but that bullet goes, as we understand it, through you, as you said, into Adrian.
Into Adrian, yeah.
And kills him.
Yeah. So I didn't find that out till much later, and it's a very, very difficult thing to come to terms with, and I'm not sure I ever will. The very bullet that didn't kill me killed Adrian. And I think no matter how well I get physically and even mentally, I think that'll always stay with me.
The police declared it a terrorist incident. Jihad al-Shami actually rang the police during it, we now know, taking responsibility before he was killed, declaring allegiance to Islamic State. You mentioned earlier Jews being shocked but not surprised. I think it's important to say it was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in Britain in recent history, many describing it as a threshold crossed, coming to kill Jews in their place of worship in Britain in 2025. What do you say to that?
I can't disagree with shocked but not surprised, because it's been building, it's been coming. There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of hate. People are justified in their opinions. If they want to think something about whatever, they're entitled to. But when you have the hate marches, when you have the anger towards Jews, you know, people can criticise a government. They're fully entitled to do that. But it shouldn't cross the line into anger towards Jews, into hate towards Jews, spilling over into this country where Jews are scared to go to certain places. It's 2025, as you say. How can we be back in a situation where Jews are scared to go? It shouldn't be happening.
You know, we should say, since Hamas's deadly attacks on Israel on October the 7th and the ensuing war in Gaza, anti-Semitic attacks and incidents have risen to the highest since records began. I'm talking about assault, threats, damage to Jewish property. There have also, and this is not irrelevant to say, there has also been a rise in Islamophobia, and it's very, very hot as an issue.
Yeah, it's a very difficult topic, and I'm not a politician, and I don't have the answers. But there is anger, because what happened on Yom Kippur morning didn't happen in a vacuum. He didn't wake up that morning and decide, I'm going to go and kill Jews. That came about as a result of the way the media have portrayed it, the way that things have been said. And you've talked about the fact, the rise in anti-Semitism, and that leads to violence. It leads to events like Yom Kippur.
Your rabbi, Daniel Walker, who you barricaded the doors with, and I've had the privilege of talking to, said Jihad al-Shami had been shaped by the widespread demonisation of Israel, and that there has to be a tackling of the source of this. You don't need to have the answers, that's not what I'm looking for, but do you have confidence that there will be a tackling of this, whatever that looks like?
I don't know. I think it's important to keep talking about it. I mean, we're 2 months on from the attack, and has anything really changed? I'm not sure it has. And I think we need to keep talking about it. We talk about the security and the levels that Jewish organisations and community buildings have to sit behind. And whilst it's great, you know, that we get the security, it sometimes feels that we're sitting behind more and more walls and more gates. And the answer to an anti-Semitic attack is to say, build another wall, build another gate, add another layer of security. Are we tackling the root cause of it? As you said, I don't have the answer. I don't have the answers, but I'm not sure we are tackling the root cause of it.
So how many more walls do you want me to sit behind?
Exactly.
That was Yoni Fenley talking to Emma in his first broadcast interview. The whole conversation is on Emma's podcast, Ready to Talk, which comes out tomorrow morning. But you can subscribe now on BBC Sounds or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. And that brings us to 8:40 and time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Catherine Pepinster, the Catholic commentator, who is here in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Justin. I've spent a lot of time this week reading the obituaries of the playwright Tom Stoppard and the founder of the independent newspaper, Andreas Whittam Smith. And while I was doing so, spotted a notable coincidence. They were born just 3 weeks apart and died the same day. At first glance, they seemed very different people. Stoppard, the Czech refugee who wrote dazzling plays such as The Real Thing and Night and Day, who was, though Jewish by birth, very secular, while Whittam Smith, a quintessentially English gentleman, was the son of an Anglican vicar with a serious faith, who also spent time as one of the church commissioners. But to me, they had far more in common than they had differences. They were committed to storytelling. Stoppard dealt in fiction, while Whittam Smith's newspaper covered the facts. And whether through the insights of stage characters or reporting events, they wanted to highlight truths about the human condition. They both, it seemed to me, shared the conviction that freedom of thought and of speech are essential to the thriving of humanity. Stoppard made that clear in many interviews. Whittam Smith wanted the newspaper he founded to not be beholden to entrenched political and economic interests. For both of them, born in 1937 in a Europe overshadowed by totalitarianism and then emerging into adulthood during the Cold War, freedom was the essence of civilization. The words of Jesus to his followers, that the truth will set you free, could well have been the leitmotif of both men's work. The next few weeks, those of Advent, are traditionally a time of preparation for the celebration of Jesus' birth. At the end of his life, stripped, beaten, mocked, he stood before Pontius Pilate, arch compromiser, pragmatic servant of the Roman Empire, the kind of regime and man that both Stoppard and Whittam Smith might well have loathed. Rather than make a decision as to what to do with Jesus, Pilate left it to the angry, bellowing crowd to demand his death. There is a moment, though, when Pilate seems nonplussed when Jesus starts talking about truth. "What is truth?" Pilate asks him. But then he walks away without waiting for an answer. What Jesus had said and inspired Pilate's question was that he had come into the world to witness to the truth. I imagine Stoppard and Whittam Smith might have empathised with that ideal. Advent is a time when Christians traditionally stop and pause to think about the big questions of faith, questions like whether they are witnesses to the truth. Others might consider that too, even if, like Pilate, sometimes they might ask, "What is truth?"
And that was Thought for the Day with Catherine Pepinster. Brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
Now, if you use the platform Spotify, you may have been poring over your data, what you listen to the most, what was your style. Apparently, I've got a listening age, Justin, if you look at Spotify Wrapped, of 30, which I'm going to take.
I'd be proud of that.
Yeah. One of the genres I apparently like the most is trip hop, which I don't even know, but I'm down with it. As you perhaps, if you do use that platform, other platforms available, as you peruse your listening habits, it is also always amusing to see what song you've listened to the most. What are the highlights of the year from the Today programme? There's a very unscientific and potentially self-indulgent look back for you here.
Hello, it's Amol here. You may know that a certain streaming service releases an annual kind of list, which they call Wrapped. It's a kind of chronicle of the things you've listened to the most over the course of a year. So we thought on the Today programme we should give you Today Unwrapped.
I heard you calling on the megaphone. You want to see me?
Who's the guest that's been on the most?
Who better to talk to than Frank Cottrell Boyce, the Children's Laureate?
And from Frank Cottrell Boyce, the Children's Laureate. Morning, Frank.
Let's bring in Frank Cottrell Boyce, Children's Laureate.
Frank Cottrell Boyce is on the line, the author of the Children's Laureate, and Catherine Rundell as well, author herself of children and adult books. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Sir Alex Younger was the head of MI6 between 2014 and 2020 and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sir Alex Younger is the former chief of MI6 and I asked him where the red line might be.
We'll reflect on that in a moment by the former chief of MI6, the secret intelligence service, Sir Alex Younger.
But let us talk to Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland, Professor of Astrophysics at Edinburgh University and someone we talk to frequently about these matters. Morning to you.
Our top sounds...
That is the sound of pine martens.
Well, you will know without me having to tell you that the first of those sounds was a nightjar, the second was a woodlark, of course, and the third, yes, a serotine bat. Ophelia lived in
fantasy. The things we seem the most obsessed by.
We've been talking throughout the programme about the news that Taylor Swift has announced her engagement to the football star Travis Kelce.
The pop juggernaut that is Taylor Swift has released her 12th album.
And all the times we've crashed the pips.
The winds will pick up quite early on, initially around the Channel Islands through West Wales and southwest England. Elsewhere then, winds turn stronger later.
After many screenings, they crafted an ending whereby...
5 seconds. Go ahead.
About 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't even have...
I think people are going to have to watch it. Do you know what? They're going to have to read your book because it's a secret history of film.
Oh, my God. They're going to love it. It's known as the Fatal Attraction ending. The scores came up 25 points and added millions of dollars to the... Are you kidding me?
Yes, we did giggle. You did too. 8 minutes to 8 is the time. Now, let us go back to more serious subjects. Why does Britain have among the highest industrial electricity prices when we keep being told that renewables, which we champion, are so much cheaper? Why indeed is electricity so expensive for all of us? The answer seems to be that we might have cheap actual generation, but the grid that gets the electricity to where it's needed is not in place, and the cost of putting it in place is huge. The so-called systems costs are not something politicians talked much about when they were all essentially signed up for net zero, but that net zero aim is now the subject of genuine debate. So this is all the context of the announcement an hour ago of the amount that companies are going to be allowed to add to bills for the upgrades necessary. And Jonathan Brearley, chief executive of Ofgem, the energy regulator that made that announcement, is here in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning. Jonathan,
tell us what you're telling the companies.
Well, what we're focusing on today are the networks. Those are the pipes and wires that bring the electricity from the generator to your home and the gas through the gas pipe into your home to make sure you have your gas heating. Now, we know that needs significant investment. So there's three main reasons for that. The first reason is we want to maintain the safe and secure system we have today. So we have one of the most resilient systems in the world. Secondly, I travel up and down the country and I'm talking to businesses who are desperate to connect to this grid, either to bring their generation on or to build new businesses like data centres. And then finally, of course, we are part of this transition where we are looking to diversify our energy mix and make sure that we are less dependent on gas. So we talk about costs, but if you look back to 22-23, that spike in the international gas prices drove huge increases in bills, and we need to protect the country against that.
What critics of all of this say, including Dieter Helm, professor of economics at Oxford, who was writing an interesting piece for The Times recently, in which he said the European gas price is now below its 5- and 10-year averages. In other words, we're being sold a bit of a myth about gas. We could depend on gas, at least for a longer period of time, gas that comes from relatively stable places, Norway, the United States, Qatar, etc. And that the idea that we have to rush into this change is wrong.
Well, I think we need to all acknowledge that gas is going to be a big part of our energy mix under any scenario, actually. So if you look at our heating systems across the country, many, many of us are on gas today, and that's not going to change quickly. You know, the real heating change will happen over the late 2020s and 2030s.
So the question then is, why don't we continue to rely on gas and indeed on oil while we're fixing the grid? Fix the grid first and then get the renewables on site rather than doing it the other way around.
Well, what we're saying is, yes, we will have gas in the mix for that time, but we don't want to just rely on gas. So the truth is, Dieter, myself, the government, no one can predict what happens to gas in the medium term. If I took you back to 2020 and I said, what are the projections for the gas price in 2020 looking forward? None of them got anywhere near close to what happened. So what we're saying is, look, we want to pay a little bit more to build the grid, want to pay a little bit more to diversify our supply.
Right. And when you say manage that, when you say we want to pay a little bit more, let's talk numbers. Sure. What the government says is that, well, they said in the budget, didn't they, bills are going to come down by £150. And actually, they're still promising, I think, £300 reduction by 2030. Feasible or not?
Well, I mean, two things. Let's look at the costs we're adding today. So we did say that to build this network over those 5 years, not starting immediately, you'll add about £108 to bills. But some of the efficiency savings, so making sure we can get the electricity going up and down the country, for example, offset about £80. So that's a net cost of around £30. Now, what the Chancellor said is she will take £150 off of bills, but we know there's a lot of factors in our bills that go up and down. So, for example, you mentioned the gas price. It is falling right now, but it will be £150 cheaper because those levies are either not being enacted or being transferred onto the taxpayer. So overall, we do see that we have three things we need to do together. First of all, it is vital, in my opinion, particularly in networks, we get this investment in place. We need a grid that's fit for purpose for this country. We have a big job to do over the next 5 years, which is to make sure that's efficient and on time. And then thirdly, all of us need to do what we can to manage the cost of living, which I know is on the top of most people's minds.
Yeah, so that gets then to the £300 by 2030 in reduction in bills. Again, feasible?
Well, when you look at the system costs overall, so just the cost of running the system, then the National Energy System Operator said that they are roughly flat, actually. So you do need policy intervention. So the policy interventions that we had, so taking those levies off of bills, are ways in which you could bring down costs. Now, it's not for us to, we can't predict exactly where you end up, but ultimately that's a matter for government, and they need to make more policy choices to make that happen.
But if they make policy choices that bring down bills, what will that do? then to the investment programme?
Well, you've got two things. You've got the investment you need to put in place, and that's our job, and that's what we do with and what we're doing today. And then you've got different ways you can manage bills. So, for example, you can increase energy efficiency programmes and you can do more to make sure you install more in people's homes. But equally, you can do what the Chancellor did in the budget. And we've been saying for some time, which is bring those levies off of bills and into the taxpayer to a more progressive way of funding some of this generation.
Right. And those are obviously political choices. Because you're saying there are political choices that would have to be made. But if those choices are made, then it is feasible that the government could do what it says it's going to do.
There are policy options for the government. But in the regulatory terms, our job is to get the investment in place and make sure it's done efficiently and on time.
Jonathan Brayley, Chief Executive of Ofgem. Thank you.
Thank you.
At 2 minutes to eight, let's catch up with Helen on the latest on the weather.
Emma, thanks very much. Hello, good morning. Low pressure with us today, so more cloud around and more widespread rain than we had yesterday. And it's going to get cold tonight, touch of frost, and tomorrow some wet and windy weather on the way as well. So very turbulent period. For today, England and Wales, band of rain currently sitting in the northwest of England, stretching through the east of Wales down towards the home counties now. And that will creep its way northwards and eastwards. So the drier weather further east disappears. We get some rain in, whilst further west, it should brighten up across southwest England, Wales, and parts of central and southern England by the end of the day, with some sunshine coming through, but some sharp showers, even the odd rumble of thunder with those coming through. Temperatures around 7 to 10. Northern Ireland also sat under that rain band, at least eastern northern areas are, but it's clearing from the west. So a gradual drying and brightening process as we go through the rest of today. Some sunshine into the afternoon here, but again, some sharp showers. Temperatures around about 7 or 8 degrees Celsius. Scotland is seeing the rain, but it's quite slow moving across southern and western areas, across the Glasgow region, and will creep its way across rest of central and southern Scotland during the rest of today. But the north may not see too much, might be a little bit brighter here as well. But temperatures only 5 to 7 degrees Celsius in that rain. It'll feel obviously quite chilly. That's it for now.
It will, Helen. Thank you very much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Bonnet.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 4th of December. The headlines this morning: the energy regulator Ofgem has approved an increase in household bills to fund investment in the gas and electricity network. A firm that operates pornography sites has been fined £1 million by Ofcom for not having tough enough age checks. We'll be hearing from Ofcom in a few minutes' time and from the campaigner Baroness Kidron. And a meeting is underway which will decide whether Israel is barred from taking part in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Also on the programme, the Health Secretary has ordered an inquiry into mental health overdiagnosis. Do we really have an overdiagnosis problem? What can be done about it? We will obviously try to diagnose. And Professor Steven Pinker on the foresight of George Orwell as he prepares to give the annual lecture in the writer's honour. But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The energy regulator Ofgem has approved the first £28 billion of an expected £90 billion programme of investment in the UK's energy networks over the next 5 years. It's expected to add around £108 a year to household energy bills by the end of that period. The investment has been welcomed by the government. A spokesperson for the Department of Energy Security said it was essential to keep the lights on. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
The energy transmission network is made up of the electricity cables, pylons and the gas pipes that transport energy from the places it's generated and extracted to the places it's actually used. Ofgem insists these investments are essential to provide a grid capable of coping with sharply rising energy demand in the future. Although the investment will add £108 to average bills by 2031, it will also mean there will be £80 less than they otherwise would have been, as it removes inefficiencies like offshore wind farms being paid billions a year to switch off as the grid can't take their power. The net rise of £28 a year acts in the opposite direction to the £150 a year the government promised to knock off bills at last week's budget. The new transmission lines will require hundreds of miles of new pylon lines and provide a test for the government's new planning powers, which aim to stop projects being delayed by objections and judicial review.
A firm operating 18 different adult websites, which are accessible in the UK, has been fined £1 million by the communications regulator. Ofcom said the company had failed to comply with the Online Safety Act, which came into force in July. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
The company AVS Group Limited did implement age verification checks across its explicit platforms when the rule to do so was enforced in the UK, but Ofcom says they're not good enough. The firm now has 72 hours to implement a more robust system for determining that its site visitors are aged 18 or over, or face an additional fine of £1,000 per day. Ofcom has also issued a separate penalty of £50,000 because it says AVS Group failed to provide it with information when required. This is the first outcome of an investigation into five different companies running porn sites, which was announced in July. It's the biggest fine so far to be issued by the regulator for non-compliance with the Online Safety Act. Ofcom has faced criticism for lacking teeth in its ability to force tech companies to abide by the UK laws, which aim to protect children from online harms.
The government has launched a consultation asking how police can expand the use of facial recognition. Some forces in England and Wales already use the technology, which the Home Office says is the biggest breakthrough for catching criminals since DNA matching. Privacy campaigners say the public should be protected against mass surveillance. Ruth Ehrlich from the advocacy group Liberty told us she wanted to see police forces given strict safeguards for using facial recognition.
It's been used for years, basically with no overarching legal framework, which means that police forces have been using it in really different ways. And we know that they're using it for really broad reasons. What we really want to see as a result of this consultation is the introduction of basically common sense safeguards that limit how and when the police can use facial rec.
The government is set to postpone elections for newly created mayors in some parts of southern England. It had announced an extension of what it called its devolution priority programme in February and said the new positions would be delivered at pace. Opposition parties are calling for the elections to go ahead as planned. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
Four parts of England were expected to vote for new directly elected mayors in May next year. But these combined authority contests in Greater Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk, Hampshire and the Solent and Sussex and Brighton are now set to be delayed by 2 years, meaning they will be first contested in May 2028. Formal confirmation is expected from the government later today. Ministers will argue that the areas need more time to reorganise local government. Opposition parties are furious. Sir James Cleverly, the shadow local government secretary, has accused Labour of trying to subvert democracy. Zoe Franklin of the Liberal Democrats said the decision was a disgrace. Reform UK Zia Yusuf said this was a blatant attempt to stop big reform wins next May.
The government has launched an independent review into the diagnosis of mental health conditions, including autism and ADHD. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said there had been a big rise in demand for mental health services in the UK, and a review was needed to ensure people were getting the appropriate care. He said earlier this year that conditions were being overdiagnosed. Will Vernon reports.
One in four adults in England now has a common mental health condition, while diagnoses among young people have risen sharply in recent years. That means the numbers claiming disability or incapacity benefits have soared, as have waiting times for those due to be assessed. Announcing the launch of an independent review, Wes Streeting said his department needed to understand why the numbers were rising to ensure people got the care they needed while bringing waiting lists down. The Health Secretary has spoken before of what he called the overdiagnosis of mental health conditions, claiming that too many people were being written off. Charities have previously urged politicians to choose their words carefully to avoid stigmatising those affected.
President Trump has said Tuesday's negotiations on Ukraine between his special envoy Steve Witkoff and Russia's President Putin went reasonably well. But Mr. Trump was unable to say if anything would come of the meeting. Mr. Witkoff will have talks with Ukrainian negotiators in Florida later today. Representatives of all 15 member states on the UN Security Council are visiting Syria this morning as the country prepares to mark 1 year anniversary of the fall of the Assad regime. The Council's presidency, currently held by Slovenia, says the trip is to learn about the challenges Syria faces. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, reports from Damascus.
This visit by all members of the UN Security Council is a measure of the dramatic change here. For years, the UN's top table was gridlocked on everything to do with Syria. Russia had been President Assad's biggest backer. The US, as well as Britain and France, supported the armed opposition. All world powers are now engaging with Syria's new leader, Ahmed al-Shara, who until recently had been designated as a terrorist for his past links to al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Last month, the Council approved a resolution to lift its sanctions against him. The envoys now want to see for themselves the immense challenges confronting the new Syria. From deep poverty to sectarian violence, Israeli attacks on its territory, and the Herculean task of rebuilding a shattered land.
The guitarist Steve Cropper, who helped define the sound of Memphis soul in the 1960s, has died at the age of 84. He was part of Booker T and the MGs, who had a hit with Green Onions, and he played on and co-wrote Otis Redding's classic Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour. The future of the Eurovision Song Contest is to be decided at a crucial meeting which starts today in Geneva. Participating countries will discuss a number of changes to the competition and may also vote on Israel's participation. Germany, which is a key financial supporter of the event, has warned it may pull out if Israel is excluded. Our music correspondent Mark Savage has this report.
Israel were the runners-up at this year's Eurovision Song Contest, but countries including Spain, Ireland and the Netherlands have threatened to boycott the competition if the country takes part next year. That's partly due to the death toll from its military action in Gaza, but there have also been accusations of unfair voting practices that helped Israel win this year's public vote. Eurovision's organisers have tried to appease those countries by introducing tighter controls on block voting. But if those proposals aren't accepted at today's meeting, it's expected there will be a vote on Israel's participation in 2026.
Cricket, and on the first day of the second Ashes test in Brisbane, Zach Crawley and Joe Root have both scored half centuries to steady England after an uncertain start, saw them lose a wicket in the first over. A short time ago, the tourists were on 176 for four. Australia lead the five-match series 1-0. And the British Geological Survey says a 3.3 magnitude earthquake hit the northwest of England late last night. The tremor was felt across Lancashire and the Southern Lake District just after 11:23. There were no reports of damage, but some residents said their houses shook.
There you go. 9 minutes past eight. How safe are we all, especially our children, online? The Online Safety Act came into force early this year after years of campaigning from people such as Ian Russell, whose teenage daughter Molly, who took her own life after seeing harmful content on the internet. But only 3 weeks ago, Mr. Russell said he'd lost faith in the leadership of Ofcom, that's the regulator in charge of policing online sites under these new laws, saying it had repeatedly failed to grasp the urgency of the task. Well, today, Ofcom has published its own report on its progress and announced a £1 million fine for a firm operating 18 different adult websites. A few minutes ago, I spoke to Oliver Griffiths, Ofcom's Online Safety Group Director, and asked him first about that fine.
This is the first £1 million fine that we've issued under the new online safety regime, and it's because they failed to live up to their duties to protect children online. And this is part of a broader tide turning that we're seeing. There have been really important changes that have happened over this year. We've seen the wholesale adoption of age checks across porn sites. There are millions of additional images of children's sexual abuse that are being filtered out by technologies. And we are seeing some of the most dangerous websites no longer being accessible to UK users.
So, now, but you're also looking into other sites. Are there plans to imminently to fine them?
Yeah, so we've, since our enforcement powers came in spring of this year, we've been investigating more than 90 websites. And yes, we're in that process where and getting to the stage where more fines will be coming through imminently.
And yes, at the same time, we know a lot of people are using VPNs to get around age verification and even being identified. What are you going to do about that?
Yeah, so look,
on adult sites, I should say.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting issue, and it's one that had a lot of prominence in the summer when the age gates came in at the end of July. In fact, if you look at the statistics, so there were about 600,000 users of VPNs daily in the UK before the ban came in. This then lifted up to over a million immediately afterwards. And what's happened over time is that's now drifted back to significantly under a million. So there's been some increase, but not wholesale. And there's been some interesting research out earlier this week showing that it doesn't seem like children are the big pickup in those numbers.
You, in terms of fining and having that backbone to this, what about making sure, and what can Ofcom do to make sure that these organisations, these companies will pay? Because if we look at what's going on with the website 4chan, you issued a fine, £20,000 on June the 10th, an extra £100 every day for non-payal. They're not just refusing to pay, they're suing Ofcom and not taking it seriously.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you'd expect, I can't talk on an ongoing court case that we've got against 4chan. But, you know, what we will do is push through against whoever isn't living up to their duties to fine them. We will always seek to recover those fines. And that's not the end of the story, because we have the ability to
go... Has anyone paid yet? Sorry, if you just don't mind me asking.
Well, look, we're very early in the stage. I mean, literally, it takes obviously a certain amount of time to do an investigation.
But you've issued fines, and I recognise it's early, but, you know, often people pay, or organisations pay fines, it can be very quickly, to make a problem go away. Has anyone paid a fine yet?
I mean, literally, I think this is the second or third fine that we have done. So, no, we haven't had a payment of a fine yet. But, you know, we have the ability to move through, if people don't pay fines, either to recover against them in court or to seek a court order for so-called business disruption measures. And that's where a site can be blocked completely from UK users.
How quickly would you move, for instance, I know you're not going to speak about 4chan, but that is a live case, but how quickly would you move to do that, to bring a site down if they don't pay? How long are you going to give them?
Well, look, we'll weigh it up in each particular case. But as soon as we've got to the stage where we have got a fine, and if people aren't paying that, or if they haven't come into compliance, and what we're seeing a lot of time is that when we do open an enforcement case, people move into compliance at that stage. But if we get to the stage where there's a fine that isn't being paid, then we, at that point, we'll be weighing up whether to go immediately into business disruption measures.
There are some who are very concerned that you're not naming and shaming already. I mean, for instance, you've looked at risk assessment records from a range of large and small services. You've told 11 providers to do more work. In addition, one major social media company, and in terms of major, there aren't that many, is going through compliance remediation with our enforcement team, which may result in formal action if you don't see sufficient improvement. Who is it?
So that will become... public knowledge at the point if we get to enforcement. But I think what's important is to understand the model that we've got here. So we have got 43 so-called supervised services. So these are ones where we have built out relationships so that people understand what their duties are, and we are able to press for compliance at that point. Now,
what's the issue? Could you give us a sense of that? Do we not have a right to know that? What's the sort of problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this particular case, and there's been an obligation on all of our supervised services to provide us with risk assessments. We had over 100 of them come back this year, that 10,000 pages of risk assessment that we've been through. And what they have to do there is assess against 17 different categories of risk. And what we saw in this particular case was that they just didn't take it seriously in terms of their risk assessment. They sent us lots of pages, but there wasn't a sense that they had really understood the risk that was there on their website. So we have gone back and told them they have to do a reassessment. And this is the process we're going through now. If they haven't taken this seriously again, then we'll be going straight into enforcement.
That's Oliver Griffiths, Ofcom's Online Safety Group Director. Listening to that, Baroness Beban-Kidron, a crossbench peer. She's the founder and chair of Five Rights, which advocates for children's rights in the digital environment. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
I mentioned in my introduction that Ian Russell has lost faith in the leadership of Ofcom. We're hearing there about a fine, the first of £1 million, yet also a fine not being paid so far. What are your faith levels like at the moment? It is, as they say, new.
I think the first thing that one has to say at the beginning of this conversation is everyone said that we couldn't actually regulate the companies. And I think that the changes that have been seen, the amount of age assurance that there is, the drop in access to pornography and self-harm is real. And what we need is more. So I'm in Ian's school. I think Ofcom should do much better. I thought your point during that interview was absolutely excellent. Why aren't they naming and shaming? Yeah, this idea that they will name when they move to compliance at that stage actually allows companies to keep it secret. And it's then one by one, instead of actually saying, we are investigating these 11 companies, and if they don't change, we'll be there. I think the other point is that Oliver said, you know, that they will go first to court to recover money, and then business disruption. These fines are nothing for these companies. Business disruption is everything. Unless we're prepared to use the law, then they are not really doing what Parliament asked them to do. So I'm absolutely clear that this law can work, but I think that we just need a whole different attitude about the level of intensity and robustness from the regulator saying, we got the law, we're using it.
Why do you think they've gone for that way around the court and then to disrupt?
I'm sure it's the right sort of escalation, but we did not anticipate that Ofcom would be so slow in its codes, so slow in its building relationships, so sort of it sees itself more as a referee between people like me and Ian on the one hand and the companies on the other. But what they've got wrong there is that they are the enforcer, and who they're representing is a young child in their bedroom who is coping with the business model of a global tech company.
Do they have the balance? I mean, they've got the law, as you say now, but are they set up to operate like that? Do they have the teeth to do that? Or does there need to be some kind of change like you're alluding to?
I think there's this, is that when I read the press release that they put out this morning, and great that there's a fine this morning, and great that there's some more coming, and we must always keep that in our mind. But so many of the details on the press release were about things that are going to happen in summer 26 and beyond, May to July, so many things. And I think that we have a level of impatience that is absolutely appropriate to two things. One is the history of the bill. It took far too long to come into law. It was lobbied and lobbied and lobbied against and watered down. And we are concerned that that is happening again in the process of implementation. I think the other thing is we've seen a huge uptick in the power of the technologies. So last week I had a big battle in the Lords. I'm trying to make sure that AI agents, often referred to as chatbots, which are ensnaring children, you know, absolutely deliberately making children dependent on them as friends and advisors, ending up, you know, with self-harm, with inappropriate relationships, in some cases, suicide in America, we've already seen. And I was pushing the government to say, is this inside the online safety regime? And if it is, where is Ofcom? And literally what we're hearing is maybe yes, maybe no. Well, that is not acceptable. We need a much faster response to the technology as it evolves, and that's only going to come if they're more robust with the powers that we have given them. And if there is a gap, they should be much quicker to say there is a gap, and the Secretary of State has powers to close that gap without new legislation. I think what we are asking for is much, much more robust implementation and quicker responses.
Baroness Beavan-Kidron, a crossbench peer and also the founder and chair of Five Rights. Thank you.
21 minutes past eight is the time. What are we to make of what appears to be the burgeoning relationship between Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, and Vladimir Putin? The Russian leader is in Delhi today. There's to be a cosy dinner for the two men tonight. The former MI6 boss, Sir John Saw, is telling us an hour ago that the White House had messed up their relationship with India. Let us talk to Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, who is travelling with Putin and joins us now from Delhi. Where are you, Stephen? Is there evidence where you are of this relationship, more than just between the two men, but between the two nations as well?
I'm looking at it now. Yes, I'm at the India-Russia Business Forum here in New Delhi. In a moment, we're expecting a big delegation of Russian government ministers to arrive, Russian businessmen. This is one of the events over the next couple of days designed to sort of boost cooperation between Russia and India. Vladimir Putin is expected to fly in later today.
and there'll be various events with his participation. So the general atmosphere here is we want to deepen the partnership between Russia and India. We were out and about this morning, and on the streets, lots of posters of Vladimir Putin saying, "Welcome, Your Excellency, President Putin." So, yeah, the general feeling here is that India's looking forward to this this visit.
Are they embarrassed at all about cozying up to someone who is not only a dictator at home, but someone who is slaughtering civilians abroad?
I don't think there's embarrassment. I think certainly the Indian authorities have tried to balance throughout the Ukraine war, but India sees Russia as an important partner. There is this strategic partnership between the two countries. And when Russia looks at India, it sees first and foremost this huge potential market, 1.5 billion population, a fast-growing economy, a market it can sell its goods to, and its natural resources, especially oil. In a sense, India buying Russian oil the last few years has been a lifeline for the Russian economy. So the Russians want that to continue, despite the pressure India is coming under from the United States. But this is about geopolitics too, because whenever Vladimir Putin goes abroad on a state visit, whether it's to India or whether it's to China, the Kremlin can use this and turns to the West and says, the West tried to isolate Russia, it slapped sanctions on Russia, it tried to turn President Putin into a pariah after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But look, there are plenty of countries, Russia would argue, and powerful countries who want to do business with Russia still.
Just turning back to Ukraine, Steve, while you're on the line, we had this discussion yesterday, didn't we, in Europe and in NATO about whether or not this Russian money that's sequestered at the moment, mostly in Brussels, actually could eventually be used. Huge sum, $200 billion or more, could be used to help the Ukrainians. It's been a point of discussion over and over again for months, indeed years. Some suggestion it might be coming to a head now. But then, interestingly, Medvedev, who I don't know how we describe him now, but you know, senior Russian politician, he has been very close to Putin, hasn't he? It's putting out on X earlier today, effectively, if you do that, we'll be at war with you, kind of threat, which you get from him, don't you? But how worried are the Russians, do you think, that if that money is released, it'll make a real difference on the ground?
I think we have to be a little bit wary. Dmitry Medvedev was a former Russian president, doesn't speak for the Kremlin. However, yes, I think the Russians are concerned. And we've heard this many times before from Moscow, warnings to Europe not to seize those frozen Russian assets, that Russia would look at that basically as theft. So I think there is concern here, and officials are looking ahead to what decision will be taken by the European Union later this month.
Steve Rosenberg in Delhi, thank you.
25 minutes past eight. Mike's back with the sport. What's going on in the Ashes?
Well, Emma, we are into the witching hour at the Gabba, approaching 6:30 in the evening in Brisbane. The floodlights in this day-night second Ashes test starting to take hold. England, remember, after winning the toss, made a horror start to day one, losing both Ben Duckett and Ollie Pope for naught inside the first three overs to leave them 5-2. But Zach Crawley and Joe Root helped England rebuild, and they finished the first session on 98-2. Opener Crawley then went for 76. Since then, Australia have made another breakthrough.
Harry Brook is 31 not out. Run a ball. And Stark, with the sun dipping, moves in to bowl to Brook. And Brook is caught at second slip by Smith. Big drive, thickish outside edge. Stark is back, and Stark takes the wicket. Brook on his way for 31.
So Harry Brook gone, England four down, meaning Joe Root has now been joined by the captain Ben Stokes at the crease. England 192-4 currently. Let's head live to the Gabba and have a quick chat with the former Australian bowler. The great Glenn McGrath is with us on the programme. Morning, Glenn.
Yeah, morning, Mike.
Australia's day so far, would you say, or is it more finely poised?
I think it's a little bit more finely poised than that. There's been certain times, obviously, the way Australia started with Mitchell Stark picking that up those early wickets, we thought, oh, here we go again. It feels very similar to Perth. But the way Crawley and Joe Root bounced back and fought back was just what England needed. Good partnership. And then against a run of play, Crawley gets out, and then Harry Brooks comes in. So I think, you know, you're looking at it, you know, 193 on the board now, 4 wickets down. You know, I think it's probably, I'd say it's been a good day for England. They're probably just slightly England's way at the moment. If they can put on a good partnership here with Root and Stokes, they can, you know, go a long way to setting this game up.
And a word on Mitchell Starc. He is the pink ball king, isn't he, for Australia, and has in this match now become the leading left-handed seam bowler, overtaking the great Wasim Akram as well to become, well, the world leader in that field.
Yeah, well, it shows just what Mitchell Starc's like and how good he is. He's always had that potential, but he just knows his game so well. He's such a dangerous bowler. 100 test matches and still bowling 145 kilometres an hour or quicker. And, yeah, to go past Wasim Akram, who was just class. He could do anything with the ball. Left arm, a swing it both ways at pace was something special. So that tells you what Mitchell Starc's like. First test, he was incredible, but under lights, the pink ball, you know, there's no better bowler in the world. So, that's a big thing for him to go past, and says exactly what type of bowler he really is.
What about the rest of the Australian bowling attack, Glenn, who perhaps haven't been so fruitful so far, except perhaps Michael Neeser, who is another pink ball specialist, isn't he?
Yeah, well, Michael Neeser, he picked up that wicket of Crawley. To be honest, you know, there's a little bit of likeness in Neeser bowling and Doggett, on this pitch here. It's not a doesn't seem to be a huge amount on offer. It is day one at the Gabba. You expect it to do a little bit more. They only left 3 mil of grass on this pitch. So, you know, Mitchell Starc's the standout. He's the danger man for England. And they've seemed to have coped quite well with the other three bowlers at the moment. It's a little strange they've left Nathan Lyon out, whether there's more to that, whether he is injured or not. But, yeah, you know, the Australian, or the English batsmen, if they can get through Mitchell Starc, it gets a little easier for them.
Yeah, Neeser now has the ball in hand, about to have a ball at the England captain, Ben Stokes. So all English hopes, Glenn, rest on these two, don't they, really? Root and Stokes at the crease currently. Root, 67 not out, and lest we keep reminding people, has never scored a century in Australia. This would be a fine time from an English point of view to get that.
Oh, without a doubt, it's a massive opportunity here for Joe Root to get his first 100 on Australian soil. You know, he's a class player. When he retires, he'll be remembered as one of the greats. And if he doesn't get 100 in Australia, it'll be a little black mark against his name. And for a player of that quality, you know, he deserves to get one over here. And this is a great opportunity for him. If they can get through the rest of the day now, it's a, you know, session and a bit. If they can somehow get through without losing any wickets, they'll be in a great position. So this partnership, very important. I know Jamie Smith's coming in next. He's pretty handy, but Stokes and Root, they're the experience of this England team, and it's now time for them to stand up.
Just a brief word on the atmosphere at the Gabba, Glenn, the day-night in the Ashes. Yep. Some talk about whether we needed that, but it certainly allows some fans to really get into the spirit of things, shall we say.
Yeah, no, I love day-night test cricket. I think it's, we've got to keep test cricket, you know, interesting and moving forward and evolving to a degree, but keep that tradition. You know, it's up against T20 cricket, and, you know, we've got to protect and look after test cricket. I think day-night cricket's the way to go about it. It is the Ashes. It probably doesn't need that because every ground's going to be packed. The amount of English fans, you know, it's 30,000 plus English fans coming out for this series. So it is massive, but the atmosphere will keep building and building. At the moment, it's a little quiet out there. It's sort of in that position where no team's got the upper hand or dominating. I think as this test on goes on, the atmosphere is going to be electric.
Certainly has been enthralling for those of us who have been up since 4 a.m. watching it. You can't take your eyes off it. Still got another two and a half hours of play to go on day one at the Gabba. Glenn McGrath, live from Brisbane, many thanks for joining us. You can follow the match and hear more from Glenn right now with the Test Match Special Team over on Five Sports Extra on BBC Sounds. England, a reminder, currently 193-4.
Mike, thank you. Later today, a fascinating series continuing here on Radio 4.
A former dictator accused of crimes against humanity.
We cannot go in history having been those who abandoned the Spanish victims.
A race against time to apprehend a seemingly untouchable man.
he had filed a flight plan on a private jet to leave at 6:30 in the morning, the next morning.
I'm lawyer and writer Philippe Sands, and I'll be retracing the frantic 5 days of a long legal battle to bring Augusto Pinochet to justice.
We need to do something.
The Arrest on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds continues on weekdays at 1:45.
A look at the weather now. Today, showery spells of rain will progress northeastwards across the UK, sunny spells and scattered showers in the south later on.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It is 28 minutes to nine. Alan Smith has the news.
The energy regulator Ofgem has approved a £108 yearly increase in bills by 2031 to fund investment in the gas and electricity networks. Ofgem says bills will be £80 lower than they would be if the investment wasn't made. An online pornography company has been fined £1 million by Ofcom for not having robust age checks in place, which became a legal requirement in July under the Online Safety Act. The firm will face a daily penalty if it does not toughen up its systems. Oliver Griffiths from Ofcom told us it was investigating 90 other websites and that more fines would be issued imminently. The government has launched a consultation asking how police can expand the use of facial recognition. The Home Office says the technology is the biggest breakthrough since DNA matching. Privacy campaigners say the public should be protected against mass surveillance. And President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is meeting Ukraine's top negotiator in Florida today as they try to agree a plan to end the war with Russia. Mr. Trump says his team had a reasonably good meeting with President Putin on Tuesday.
Thank you for that. 26 minutes to nine is the time. The government has launched an independent review into the diagnosis of autism, of ADHD and of mental health conditions. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said there'd been a big rise in demand for mental health services in the UK. A review was needed to ensure that people were getting the appropriate care, as he put it. He had said earlier in the year, in fact, that conditions are being overdiagnosed. In a moment, we will talk about this with a consultant psychiatrist. First, though, I talked to the neurologist Suzanne O'Sullivan, whose book, The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far, made the case for the overdiagnosis, or that the overdiagnosis of milder examples of ADHD was having a damaging impact. Here's just a clip of that interview that we ran earlier in the year.
If you take a young person and you conceptualize their difficulties as ADHD or any brain developmental disorder, then what you're potentially doing is affecting that person's identity formation, their hopes for their future, their belief in their ability to overcome those symptoms.
Because they think of myself as a young person, as a child, they think I am damaged in some way.
Well, I think the concern is that if you frame something as a biological neurodevelopmental disorder, what is that saying to a child? It's saying my brain isn't normal and I can't overcome this thing. So I'm not in any way saying that children aren't struggling and don't need help. What I'm saying is that is the correct way to help those children a medical label, or should we not be able to recognize, hey, this kid is struggling in school? Perhaps they need a bit of extra support, but do we need to label their brains as abnormal to give them that support?
That was the neurologist Suzanne O'Sullivan talking to me earlier in the year. Let us talk now to Dr. Jessica Eccles, who is a consultant psychiatrist who specialises in ADHD and autism and chair of the Royal College of Psychiatrists Neurodevelopmental Special Interest Group. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
What do you think the government ought to be doing? They're going to hold this review. What should they be looking at?
I think they need to seize the nettle and they need to make a real difference to people who really need it. So I think that the idea of overdiagnosis or that these labels could be problematic is missing the real point. The real point is that autistic people, people with ADHD, people with mental health conditions, there is huge unmet need that is affecting all sectors of society, education, health, criminal justice. And we know that people with ADHD and autism are overrepresented in mental health populations. Probably one-fifth to a half of patients in community mental health teams are in fact autistic or have ADHD. People with ADHD and autism die earlier. They're more likely to die by suicide. And the ADHD Task Force report found that ADHD is underdiagnosed, undertreated, and the economic impact of ADHD alone is £18 billion.
Has it always been, though? I mean, from your perspective, is it that we have just woken up to something that was always there, or are we iller, more impacted by life than we used to be?
I think there aren't simple answers to those sort of questions. I think it's a combination of two things. One is a huge increase in awareness. Do you know that last year, ADHD was the number two search condition on the NHS website? But what we are realising is we have been missing people for years and years. Women, people from ethnic minorities, people who do not present typically, adults, we have been missing ADHD and autism diagnoses in those people. So we're catching up. But there are also other intersecting factors. So socioeconomic impacts, the effect of COVID on people's lives. And basically, ADHD and autism are features that you are most likely born with, but there are certain transitions and changes that can mean that you can no longer mask, and that your that the demand has exceeded
capacity. But that then takes us back to Susanna Sullivan, what she was saying, that actually if those things do exist, and to an extent have always existed, actually is the right thing to medicalize them. Even to give them a name, or just hear me out on this. Let me put what some in the government might be saying. Are we actually just incentivizing people through the benefit system, through the entire system, actually the NHS as well, through the educational system, incentivizing people to regard themselves as damaged when they're just human beings?
Well, I would counter that. So there is this narrative that of these diagnostic labels giving people a sick note for life. That is categorically not the case. We know from research that has been published, and also from our clinical experience, that diagnostic labels of ADHD, autism, mental health conditions are transformative. They change lives. They save lives. And recognizing them will help save the economic impact of the untreated nature of these conditions at the moment. We need to put our heads together, and the government back up the, rise to the challenge of how do we meet the unmet need. The label provides access to support. That support means that people can get back into education, work, training, relationships.
We're out of time, but let's see what they do come up with when it comes to what those things will be. Fascinating stuff. Jennifer Eccles, thanks very much for talking to us.
It's 20 to 9.
And let us turn to the United States. US immigration officials have begun an operation in New Orleans to arrest undocumented immigrants. The Trump administration would call them illegal immigrants. It's the latest city to be targeted by President Trump's crackdown. A series of sweeping raids, mostly in Latino communities. Officials say they're targeting, initially at least, those with criminal backgrounds. There is a backlash, though, in the Democrat-run city, as Tom Bateman reports from New Orleans.
Wait, CBP car.
Let's go.
Yes.
We're on the road in New Orleans, and we spot a convoy of Border Patrol agents up ahead. How do I get over there? Vans with blacked out windows hurtling towards a Latino neighbourhood.
They're going quite fast.
Can you keep your eye on it?
Yeah.
These guys on the left.
The convoy speeds away. We can't catch up, but are soon alerted to a raid. We get a report of labourers working on a roof and Border Patrol agents now surrounding the house. We arrive to find two activists who filmed it.
Hi, we're with BBC News.
Zoe Higgins and the Reverend Jane Malden are on the pavement. Among the neighbours here, wondering how President Trump's new front line on undocumented migration just arrived in their street.
They took workers off the roof
and
actually had a sniper gun positioned pointing at the workers.
Pointing up.
What went through your mind when you saw that?
Heartbreak. These people came to work today to provide for their families and themselves, and They could just be abducted and removed from all stability.
Later, Border Patrol officials say their agents were carrying out enforcement operations in the neighbourhood and that several men ran up onto the roof, who were then taken into custody.
Well, we just followed the Border Patrol. I caught them at this junction here. There were several vehicles. There's another one passing. Some masked Border Patrol agents. We don't know where they're off to now, but the other thing you can notice is everywhere they have been, they're now being followed by activists and people trying to document exactly what they're doing.
The fear of raids is leaving much of New Orleans' Latino community in lockdown. The door is unlatched for us at Abigail's Mexican restaurant. The family running this business for two decades now sleeps in the restaurant at night, fearing getting caught up in the Border Patrol crackdown. In the kitchen, chimichangas are fried, and Abigail's mum, Sandra, reveals her worry for friends and family.
Triste. She feels sad.
Porque aquí llevamos 20 años.
She's been here 20 years in this country.
Tenemos una casa.
She got her own house. She got her business. And she working hard like every single day.
How's it affected business?
All this business is from immigrants. A lot of people, they come over here and trying to eat a plate. But right now, it's like nobody wants to come over here. They feel afraid to go out. They feel scared to go out.
Another day, and we're back on the road, heading out over one of the world's longest bridges, a 24-mile span over Lake Pontchartrain, connecting New Orleans to the North Shore. While Mr. Trump promised America's biggest ever deportation operation at the election, the Border Patrol raids do little to span America's divides.
Are these all yours? Oh, wow.
In the Republican-dominated town over the lake, we find Trump supporters who back the operation alongside those who think it's gone too far.
I just have mixed feelings about it, because what if this mom is here with her husband, who's legal, and her children, and she's working, why would you take her? You know, as opposed to, okay, someone who has a record and someone who is perhaps not working and has committed some crimes.
They're not here legally, if they're illegal. And, you know, you could be working as hard as everyone else out or harder, because a lot of them do work a lot harder than everyone else. But if they're here illegally, they're not allowed to be here. They should get out.
At Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, the band is mixed, mostly from Venezuela. The pianist, Roberto Matthews, is Cuban-American. He plays while he pays tribute to his fellow congregants in this, the City of Sounds, suddenly sparse in number.
The melting pot that is New Orleans, its carpet has been pulled out from under the people, unfortunate. And as you can see, there's very few people that have been brave enough to come to the Mass, you know, and it's a really sad situation.
The sermon in Spanish is now given to mostly empty pews. America's debate rages on immigration, but many in this neighbourhood are just praying for more time.
Tom Bateman reporting. It is a 8:45. Paddle, originally from Mexico, is having another moment as the fast-growing racket sport continues its rise in this country. Today is the start of the very first Lawn Tennis Association Paddle National Championships to be held in Bristol. Jason Manford, you'll know him as a comedian, of course, but he owns JM Paddle Academy and is also an LTA Paddle Ambassador. I did not know that. Jason, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
I'm very well. And you're keen on this, as many other people seem to be. Is this one of those moments to kind of take in the rise, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I got into it about 3 years ago, but it's just gradually got bigger and bigger and it's definitely an obsession, I think that's safe to say.
If someone has not played it, they may have heard it, they may have heard the thwacking, yeah. And there's been some complaints if you live near these courts of that sound. Can you describe it?
Well, yes, I can. Because when you first do it, it's still, even now, even though, like you said, fastest growing sport in the world, people will still say, is it on water? Do you not get your balls wet, etc.? And as it were, sorry, I'm in panto season.
It's all right, I like it.
And it's not that, of course. It's a mix between tennis and squash. So it's played in doubles. You play in a smaller court, and the ball rarely goes out because you've got these glass walls around you, which, like in a game of squash, you can use to get the ball over. So it's got, I guess, what's much more fun about it, you know, as much as I love tennis, is that the ball is sort of constantly in play, so your rallies are longer, and also when you're amateur, you haven't got ball boys, have you? So you don't have to keep going to get your ball.
You do not. And for those who are, some have said if they're less fit as well, they find it a bit easier than running around.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend
tennis
that
court.
That's one of its alerts.
Okay. I mean, I did sort of say it quite lightly, but the sound complaint element is real depending on where these courts are situated. A council has said it's considering enforcement action after residents complained about the noise from outdoor paddle courts near their homes. That's one story of many, it seems, this year.
Yeah, I've read that. I mean, obviously I'm biased because I love the sport and I'm trying to get it everywhere. But I imagine if you live next door to one, it can be pretty loud. But it's sort of no more or less loud than a, you know, if you were living near some five-a-side or some actual tennis with the amount of grunting that goes on. So
are you a grunter when you paddle or play?
I'm a backhand grunter, yeah.
How bad are we talking?
You know, I mean, I'm not going to do it for you, but yes.
I thought you were in panto season. I thought we were going to get the Monica Sellers or to that effect.
Yeah, I do make some exertion noises, yeah.
Not even I could get Jason Manford to grunt on Radio 4.
No.
Well, it is the first Lawn Tennis Association, which is slightly confusing, but the LTA are now operating paddle as well, aren't they? The LTA
yes.
Paddle National Championships held in Bristol. You're not competing, Jason, though?
Not yet, no. I don't know where I am on the list, but I didn't get the call up. But you know, that's sort of why I set up the JM Paddle Academy. It's a charity to try and get sort of underprivileged kids to be able to play this sport as well, because it is growing fast, and we are as a country, you know, Team GB going to be, you know, competing. It looks like it might make the Olympics in the next sort of 8 years or so, and it's just trying to make sure that everybody has got a chance to play it, because who knows who's out there who could actually represent the country.
A very important point to end on. Jason Manford, thank you.
10 to 9 is the time.
Now, I don't know if you've seen this, but there have been, of course, many tributes paid to Sir Tom Stoppard, one of the UK's best-known and celebrated playwrights since his death, aged 88, was announced at the weekend, from His Majesty the King to Sir Mick Jagger to many fellow well-known writers. But it's another tribute that has appeared in the letters section of the Times newspaper that has caught many people's attention and imagination. It's from a professor and doctor who specialises in breast cancer treatment, who experienced quite a moment when watching one of Sir Tom's best-known plays, Arcadia, in the 90s. This was the moment in the play that struck Professor Michael Baum, performed here for BBC Radio in 1993. Emma Fielding plays Thomasina, who's confronting her tutor, Septimus, played by Rufus Sewell.
God's truth, Septimus, if there is an equation for a curve like a bell, there must be one for a curve like a bluebell. And if a bluebell, why not a rose? Do we believe nature is written in numbers?
We do.
Then why do your equations only describe the shapes of manufacture?
I do not know.
And thus God could only make a cabinet.
He has mastery of equations which lead into infinities where we cannot follow.
What a faint heart.
And so it goes on. And at the time he saw the play, Professor Michael Baum was working on adjuvant systemic therapy, something first invented by Bernard Fischer and Gianni Bonadonna. And he found Arcadia's depiction of chaos theory helped with his understanding of how to potentially treat breast cancer. Professor Michael Baum, I managed to talk to him. He explained why that moment inspired him so much.
It was a eureka moment about not the use of chemotherapy. It was a eureka moment about understanding breast cancer better than we have ever done before. It's to do with the model, the mathematical model that explains breast cancer.
Just to take me back to that moment in the 90s, I mean, were you kind of fizzing with excitement in the interval, for instance, you know, talking to whoever you went with?
Yes.
Was it your wife? Who were you with?
My wife and another couple, what we had just watched was the discovery of chaos theory. And to me, it illustrated the genius of Tom Stoppard, that he could fit in so many things in one play. But in that play, Arcadia, he describes the discovery of chaos theory. And I'll explain a bit about what chaos theory is. But the point of the letter, the point of my excitement, was chaos theory explains the enigma of breast cancer. Now, just as an illustration of the enigma that we're dealing with, it's very close to my heart. My lovely sister died of breast cancer about a year ago, 25 years after she had been diagnosed. So you have to be able to explain why some patients die within the first few years and some very late afterwards. In order to explain that, you cannot just sit back and say it's linear.
Yes.
And by linear, I mean it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger with time.
Is it possible, Professor Baum, to also just do share a word or two on art and science and art and the inspiration there? Because I think the complexity of Stoppard's work and what he was trying to convey, I know also mattered greatly to you.
I'm passionate about it. My official title is Emeritus Professor of Surgery and Visiting Professor of Medical Humanities. So I'm passionate about how the humanities and science work together.
I have to say, in terms of what we say about that, we don't often talk about those links. And I think your letter has got people talking about that, and it's captured people's imaginations, which is why it's so lovely to have you on the programme this morning.
Well,
so
if I've achieved that, I tell you, it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. There are lots of surgeons, there's lots of scientists, but the idea that the arts and the sciences are part of the same activity, because just to generate a hypothesis is imagination.
Of course. Well, Professor Baum, thank you very much for firing ours this morning. Lovely to talk to you.
And let us, at 5 to 9, stay with the life of the mind, because one of the great tropes of modern times is that modern times are awful, the world has fallen apart. It is probably fair to say that one man above all others has led the charge for the opposite case, that things have actually been getting better. And that man is Professor Steven Pinker of Harvard University, the cognitive psychologist whose books about life and thought have been bestsellers for years. He's giving the Orwell lecture tonight in London. It's entitled 1984 and 2025. It's at the Southbank Centre, the Queen Elizabeth Hall, in case you can get there. And Professor Pinker is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Is 2025 1984?
It is not, although that's a tempting rhetorical device to depict anything that you don't like or anything that gives you the creeps in the worst possible light to say, well, it shows that 1984 is already here. Now, of course, government lying has always been with us. War has always been with us. Poverty has always been with us. But the nightmare depicted in 1984, at least if taken literally, is just not the state of the world now. At least the numbers belie that.
What some say about life in the West, and I suppose they say it particularly about this country, and the American right actually says it about this country, about Britain, doesn't it, is that it is properly Orwellian, because you have people arrested for what they say online, you have all sorts of ways in which people seem or think themselves to be oppressed in an Orwellian fashion. What is your response to that?
Well, there are genuine threats to free speech, and there always have been. But if you try to say, are they worse today than they were yesterday? They do take place today. We ought to oppose them. But have things gotten better or worse? Then you can look at organizations that rate countries in terms of their degree of liberal democracy. And the UK has gone down a bit in the last 10 years. It's still one of the freest countries in the world, and it's freer today than it was when Orwell wrote his novel in 1948. Which, of course, doesn't mean it's perfect. There are threats to free speech.
Which are?
Well, for example, the harassment of people under non-crime hate incidents, an elastic category that means that if anyone is offended, they could snitch on one of their neighbors for a tasteless social media post, and the police could be on at their door. That certainly, there's something a little bit Orwellian about that network of informants, and the lack of rule of law, namely some kind of stipulated infraction that you could be arrested for, as opposed to just being offensive or subversive.
There is also a suggestion among some that science has become corrupted in a kind of Orwellian way. I mean, the obvious example, I suppose, that they would give is when people aren't able to say that there are two sexes and a difference between the sexes and you can't change sex, and aren't able to say that freely in universities, perhaps in some journalistic settings, and that wouldn't have been the case some years ago, and that is a real change, and a change in a backward direction.
I think it is, but again, it's not exactly the Ministry of Truth. Again, looking at the best indicator that we have of how of the state of discourse and on a science, things have gotten worse in the last 10 years. Still, they could get worse without being the Ministry of Truth.
Yeah, and they could, of course, get better as well. I mean, you're not a great fan of President Trump, are you? But, is there a backlash that you can see? A kind of correction would be a better way of putting it.
Absolutely. And I co-founded the Council on Academic Freedom at Harvard because my colleagues and I thought that there is too much repression of speech and thought, that students are afraid to speak their minds, that professors get investigated probably for the content of their ideas and research. So we are pushing back from within the university. There's an active alumni association that's holding the administration's feet to the fire. The current administration is sympathetic. They acknowledge that things have gone too far.
Professor Steven Pinker, always a pleasure to talk to you. The Orwell Lecture 2025 is 1984 and 2025 is